Belgians woke up Saturday morning to something they haven't seen in more than 30 years. The deployment of soldiers from the armed forces in two Belgian cities, Brussels and also Antwerp. And this is in response to some of the security threats that have emerged, not only in the wake of the Charlie Hebdo attack in Paris, but also after police went after a suspected jihadi cell in the eastern Belgian city of Verviers. It resulted in a gun battle Thursday night in which two suspects were killed and a third was taken prisoner. Now, Brussels is not only the capital of Belgium.
Welcome to another edition of Banda Now!
Welcome to another edition of the Sunday Wire. I'm your host, Patrick Henningsen. Thank you for joining us this week for this very important broadcast. We're streaming out live on the ACR network. That's the alternate current radio network.com and 21stCenturyWire.com. You can listen to the live stream this afternoon or after the show. We'll have the recordings up and we'll be also on podcast networks like iTunes and Stitcher and Mixcloud, and many others. Thank you for joining us. Again, I'm your host, Patrick Henningsen, and it's been a busy week, to say the least. If you joined us last week, you'll know exactly how serious and how significant the news that's just come, you know, on the scene this very young new year in January 2015, and it's definitely game-changing in many ways. In other ways, it's not. It's the same old game. But there's some new things that have been introduced into the conversation by our powers that be. Our mainstream media and our government have introduced new talking points and fused old ones together with new ones to lay out some sort of what plan for society that they have. And I have to say it's pretty disturbing, some of the things that have been coming out this week. So we're going to have a few special guests with us who are going to join us. Last week we did speak to Kurt Haskell, and he was a witness to the underwear bomber in Detroit and laid out exactly what a bogus event that was. If you missed that interview, you want to go back and listen to it. That's, I believe, episode 67 of the Sunday Wire. You can see it on the archives at 21stCenturyWire.com. Excellent interview with Kurt. We're hoping to get him back this week. We're hoping to reconnect Kurt this week because there's so much that he had to offer in this conversation, and we want to continue where we left off because it is an important conversation. This is a piece of history which will affect our day-to-day lives in one way or another. In one way or another, what happened in France over the last couple weeks is going to affect us in some way in terms of legislation or regulations or freedom of speech, freedom of the press. It's not going to increase, it's going to decrease. We've seen the signs of that already in the UK. The Orwellian agents are at it again, wanting to use the broad brush of what they consider to be extremist language, thought, or anything like this. They're working on bundling everything together in one little package, which is that if you have any opinions that differ from government-sanctioned opinions, then you are then classed as an extremist. Of course, Eric Blair, George Orwell, warned us about this many years ago. He being an ex-BBC employee, he knew all about propaganda. And quite prophetic, in my estimation, I would say Orwell is the Nostradamus of the 20th century. The Nostradamus of the 20th century, without a doubt. How he could predict the mindset of today's technocrats so accurately is incredible. It's breathtaking right now to watch it unfold. So we'll see. We will see. So that's Kurt Haskell. Hopefully we're going to connect Kurt. And also we have a 21st Century Wire contributor and a writer named Jay Dyer. You might be familiar with Jay's work. Jay is an incredible and insightful commentator. And on this subject, he got right in there from the beginning. And you might see some of his articles on 21st Century Wire regarding the Paris attacks and many others. Jay is what I would call a film analyst, but much more than that. Jay Dyer sees films as a kind of window into many events, be they staged or unstaged, which happen every day and throughout history. And film is a window, like literature, is to go in and glean more insights than what we would normally see just by casually passing over these events. So we're going to look forward to that conversation. We're going to get into some of the deeper aspects, the Bader-Meinhofer-style terrorism. If you remember the Gilded Age of political terrorism back in the 1970s, when you had these cutout groups like the Bader-Meinhofer gang in Germany and people like Carlos the Jackal, running around, going from group to group. Basically, whoever was open for business, people would move from group to group. And, of course, the hidden hand of the intelligence agencies were there in the background helping to stage manage this puppet show of terror. And today's theme of the show is Terror's Theater Bazaar. And it is episode 68. It's January 18th, 2015, and this is the gift that keeps giving. The story has kept developing. It's an extraordinary story, and, you know, let's start off with Charlie Hebdo. Okay, what we find out is, we talked about this with Tony Gosling last week as well, another great, great segment that we had last week in episode 67, but Charlie Hebdo's, before this happened, you have to understand what Charlie Hebdo magazine was and still is, okay? Before this happened, Charlie Hebdo, and I wouldn't call it a satirical magazine. That term's being kicked around a lot. There's nothing satirical about Charlie Hebdo and the work they do. It's a magazine. It's a political cartoon magazine. And I would class it as it's political pornography, basically. It was so bad, they couldn't give this magazine away before these attacks. They couldn't give it away. Okay? This was a failing publication. They claimed to print, before this, 60,000 issues per week, okay? And now, that's not all 60,000 sold, okay? The sales figures we couldn't get. My estimation is they're probably selling about maybe 40,000, maybe 30,000. They probably get a lot of returns from the news agents. If you understand publishing and periodicals, you know what that means, sent back to the publisher. They print 60,000, they probably sell, I don't know, between 60, maybe 70% of that. And so in a country of 60 million or 70 million, whatever France is, a real circulation in terms of sales of 30, 40,000, it's a spit in the bucket, basically. No impact whatsoever on French society. So we're looking at this magazine. It's failing. I think they tried to do a fundraiser back in December, just before this happened, actually. And so, lo and behold, the attacks happen, and all of a sudden there's an artificial demand created for what was before a failing product that nobody really cared about or wanted to actually pay money for. Okay, so what do you have here? You have something that, in order to survive, needs a subsidy. So the subsidy which was given to Charlie Hebdo came in the form of a terrorist attack. Now, I'm not saying there's any connection between the two. This, the Charlie Hebdo is a had a political target painted on it. Therefore, it could be used by a number of groups, clandestine or otherwise, in order to, you know, jar political leverage from this sort of controversial work, which they're being egged on by the far right and other places to increase social division within France. And to Charlie Hebdo is kind of a mascot, if you will, militant atheists wanting to be controversial, very controversial, and that's it, controversy for controversy's sake. That pretty much sums up the magazine. Okay, no one actually was interested in reading it. They're sort of like, well, it's kind of a nuisance. It's costing the state money to provide security. France, French law says that they don't have allow blasphemy to get in the way of free speech in France. So fair enough. The state's going to take it on the chin and provide security. So then the attacks happen. And now we're told this 7 million copies sold. Okay, 7 million. So where did they get the money to print up the 7 million copies after the attacks? Well, it turns out they got a bailout from the government. They were able to raid a fund which was financed by Google. So Google has indirectly given the money to Charlie Hebdo. That was actually a fund when Google and France were having their tax row in 2013. That was the sort of compromise that the French government says, well, if you want to operate in France, you got to give us 50 million euros. We'll stick it in a fund and we'll distribute that to French digital publishers to help them increase their advertising revenues. Okay, so Google said, yeah, we want to stay open in France. Here's 50 million, gives it to Francois Hollande. He sticks it in a little bank account and says, we'll give that to French online digital publishers to help increase and improve the economy of French publishing, because they had a bit of a European-wide controversy over Google News feeds. I don't want to get into the inside baseball of that story, but you can look it up. Google in Spain, Google Germany, Google France had these similar legal battles. Okay, so what happens? They look at this fund. So that was supposed to go to help the French economy. Instead, they just gave it to Charlie Hebdo. And if you looked at some of the covers of some of these Charlie Hebdo magazines, it's beyond pornography. It's just outright disgusting. I'm not talking about the 2009 cover, I was saying 2010, 2009 of The Prophet, which attracted the original controversy. I'm talking about all the other ones. I mean, really, really sick. There's some very sick and twisted people there. I, for one, am not going to jump out in front of a bus for Charlie Hebdo, okay? Not because of issues of free speech or expression or freedom of the press. These are not journalists. Cartoonists are not journalists. Cartoonists are cartoonists, okay? What they do is not journalism. It's cartoonist. So a political cartoonist is a political cartoonist. And some political cartoonists are journalists, but Charlie Hebdo, these French cartoonists, I wouldn't class them as journalists. If you think Mad Magazine is journalism, then, or Viz Magazine in Britain, then yeah, you could call them a journalist. But I actually don't class that as journalism. Okay, Viz is actually more satirical than Charlie Hebdo. So there you go. And now the money comes flowing in from the French government. They got a bailout. Isn't that incredible? And what do they print on their opening gambit after the dust clears from the bombs and the, you know, they scoop up the dead bodies, debrief the world on this event, and they, of course, put the Prophet Muhammad on the cover and say, what a wonderful statement of freedom that is. Okay. I sense a bit of agent provocateur here with this magazine. And yeah, they've sold 7 million copies, but sales will drop drastically unless they raise their game, because if you look at their cartoons, and it's not just a French thing. The French aren't into it either. There's a demand for it. It's because of the attacks. When that demand drops, the magazine will be exactly back where it was before, in need of subsidies, because no one's buying it. It's not interesting. Okay? It's a niche. It's got a very small niche, and that niche will shrink over time. Without the controversy, there is no demand for this magazine. Without the terror, there is no demand. So, good luck to Charlie Hebdo. They've got enough money to probably keep going for a couple of years. They have achieved cult status on many fronts. So, congratulations. Let's listen to... I'm going to play the audio clip, Charlie Hebdo audio clip. Go ahead. And this is one of their journalists, quote unquote, was being interviewed this morning, I think by Brian Seltzer Bottle at CNN. Reliable sources. Go ahead and play Charlie Hebdo, the audio clip.
Let me play a bit of audio from the current top editor of the magazine, Gerard Biard. He was in London at the time of the attack, so he was not in Paris, he was not at the office. And this morning on NBC's Meet the Press, he spoke for the first time to American television about the new cover and about the controversy surrounding it. Here's what he said about the decisions by some news outlets, including CNN, not to show the cover.
Listen. We cannot blame newspapers that already suffer much difficulty in getting published and distributed in totalitarian regimes for not publishing a cartoon which could cost them, at best, jail, and at worst, death. On the other hand, I am quite critical of newspapers which are published in democratic countries. This cartoon is not just a little figure, a little Mohammed drawn by Luz. It's a symbol. When they refuse to publish this cartoon, when they blur it out, when they decline to publish it, they blur out democracy, secularism, freedom of religion, and they insult the citizenship.
CNN executives and executives at other news networks and newspapers have said they're not showing the cover because of safety concerns for staff members, particularly in the Middle East. How do you respond to that?
At least speaking about safety, because I'm remembering that in 2006, where already some American and UK journalists did refuse to show the Danish cartoons. It was in the name of protecting religion, protecting the feelings of some believers. And my reaction to that is that if we censor ourselves when we are under a huge attack like this threat, if we do not show the drawings that the fanatics don't want to see, it's like exactly don't, like not showing the film that North Korea do not want to see. It's the same problem. We are killing ourselves, our rules of democracy. We are already under a dictatorship if we cannot show a simple drawing just by fear. And of course it's a huge betrayal. It's very offending. Not offending for believers, it's offending for journalists. It's offending for freedom of speech, it's okay. Offending for democracy.
I hear what you're saying.
Okay, that was, she was from Charlie Hebdo, and she's talking about the terrorists and the cartoons, and we shall not bow down to the terrorists. Okay, right. So the cartoons the terrorists don't want you to see. Okay, first of all, who are the terrorists? Okay, are there any intelligence agencies, any covert informants, any patsies involved in this story? Because if there are, if there's even one involved anywhere in this story, that delegitimizes the entire official narrative and wave which everyone is currently surfing on. Do you understand the gravity of what I just said? If there is even one character involved somewhere in this story, and we've already pointed out there's more than a couple. So then it delegitimizes the whole story. So it's not just cartoons the terrorists don't want you to see. The French themselves don't want to see these things. Well, before this attack. Okay. Now, I told you this last week. We didn't republish the old cover of the Prophet on Charlie Hebdo, because it's Well, poor taste to begin with. Just about every other Charlie Hebdo cover. It's kind of like really disgusting adolescent political porn. Okay? Really disgusting. Look at some of these covers. Very much pushing this kind of homosexual narrative, mixing and kind of pornography mixed with religion. It's really sick kind of stuff. Very provocative. It wants to get a reaction, and it wants a violent reaction, which is why they do it, which makes me question the whole basis of this magazine and why it exists. Okay? A failed publication. Before last week, it was a failed publication in need of subsidies. So that's it's a narrative that it's going to die pretty quick. There'll be a backlash. People will become very disinterested in Charlie Hebdo very soon. It's already starting to happen. The novelty is worn off. And here we are back in the real world. So we're going to talk about this with our next guest about the ins and outs of this. Now, just quickly, I'm going to play a YouTube clip. This is Stuart Hooper. He's a contributor to 21st Century Wire. Wrote an absolutely fantastic article called Charlie Hebdo Attacks. And you want to go check this out at 21st Century Wire. If you look over in the trending column on the right, you'll see Stuart's article. It's entitled Charlie Hebdo, False Flag in Paris, Theory, Evidence, and Motive. Go ahead and just play this clip real quick from Stuart Hooper, this YouTube clip.
This theory suggests that four key aspects are required for the successful execution of a false flag terror operation. Number one, patsies, dupes, and useful idiots. These are the people which you will see on the front page of newspapers and on the evening news as those allegedly responsible for the attack. They can have the will to perform terroristic actions, but usually are of low mental ability, lacking the means and technical capabilities to do so. In some cases, they will think that they are carrying out an attack, but it is also possible for patsies to not be aware they are about to be framed. They must be under a level of supervision, yet free to fulfill their role. 2. Professional executioners. These are the actors that have the means and technical capabilities to perform terroristic actions. They usually have to be unseen, at least personally, although their actions will not be, throughout the entire false flag event. This allows them to shift blame upon the useful idiots at a later point. 3. Privatized command structure. This is the ever-elusive, shadowy element of false flag terrorism, the instigator and bankroll, neither seen nor heard of, and can be tricky to specifically identify. 4. Controlled corporate media. Through means of monopolized ownership and coercion, a controlled corporate media is required to immediately espouse the story of the useful idiots, not professionals, being responsible. In short, the privatized command structure employs the use of professional executioners and technicians for whatever motive they have to instigate a terroristic incident. Following this, a patsy is placed on the scene, sometimes materially, sometimes rhetorically, and immediately blamed, often with zero evidence and by an unnamed source as being the perpetrator. The controlled corporate media will then run with this version of events as factual, whether it is or not, and sometimes even seek to discredit ideas to the contrary. What we must now attempt to do is see whether any evidence and facts from the Charlie Hebdo shooting points to the presence and operation of patsies, professional executioners, and a privatized command structure. Evidence. Our first point of inquiry comes from the accused perpetrators allegedly being Muslims. This led to the event being declared an act of Islamist terrorism, as the attackers shouted Allahu Akbar. The foreign policy article goes on to state that the attackers were captured on video shouting Islamist slogans and claiming they had attacked the paper to avenge the Prophet Muhammad. Although this is what was seen and heard, it does not mean that this is what you were seeing. Anyone can shout Islamist slogans, whether they are Islamic or not. And, as the attackers were disguised behind masks, we cannot assume that they were indeed the Islamic extremists we are being told they are. Now, remember the role for professional executioners and technicians is to carry out the event and helps place blame upon the patsy to be blamed later on. The use of such slogans can, therefore, be seen as evidence of an attempt to frame an Islamic patsy and steer the subsequent narrative in the direction of Islamic extremism, away from any other potential source of terrorism which could have otherwise been plausible. This attempt at steering a narrative was furthered once more by a claim allegedly being made by a representative of the group Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula in Yemen. The problem here is, once again, that this was provided on condition of anonymity.
It did not. Anonymity. Anonymity. That is the key word. Anonymity. I can't tell you how many times in the last 2 weeks I've seen any of this bevy of terror experts and national security correspondents and national security analysts on CNN, ABC, Fox, or any of these networks who are stage managing this event, and I'll put the BBC in there as well. They're doing the same thing. Anonymous sources tell us, or our sources within French police, or our sources within the counterterrorism department in Paris. I mean, who are they? Who are they? They could just be making all this up as they go along. And in many cases, we've found out that what is being presented as fact on the air to the masses is, in fact, pure speculation based on evidence that doesn't exist, based on speculation. Speculation on top of speculation on top of speculation, throwing a little hyperbole and some anonymous sources, and you have a narrative. Voila. C'est narratif. Beautiful narrative. Wonderful. And that's what they're riding off of. Constantly. Chilling new information. ISIS trophy brides. New suspects. Troops on the streets of Europe. What next? Obama speaks to David Cameron. Our anonymous sources tell us. It's endless. It's absolutely endless. And we will bring all this together at some point for you to actually hear all their sort of propaganda live in real time. But we're going to take a short commercial break and connect our first guest, Kurt Haskell. We've got him on the line. Looking forward to this interview. You don't want to miss it. We'll be right back. This is the Sunday Wire. I'm your host, Patrick Henningsen. This is the Terror Theater Bizarre. We'll be right back.
I've had enough of working 9 to 5. In a job where I'm working to survive. And to myself, I can't tell no more lies. I've spent too much time in the shadows. There's nowhere else to hide.
Everything you need from your your water filters and storage to military and tactical headwear and firearm accessories. Whether it's that bug out bag or anything you would want to have inside it, Heavy Cover Inc. has the reliable, high quality items you are going to need. With standard, express, and even international shipping, you can have everything you need within days from ordering. When I started hoping for the best, but planning for the worst, my first stop was HeavyCoverInc.com. Survival kits, cover from the elements, outdoor and prep gear of all kinds. Check out Heavy Cover. You'll be glad you did.
Tune in to the Red Pill Radio Show with me, your host, Ashley John. Monday through Thursday from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Take the Red Pill and see how deep the rabbit hole goes.
Cosmic's Corner of the Universe. Ignition sequence start. 10.
Astrophage.
9.
Cancer.
8.
SSRI.
7.
Methanol.
6.
Electronic surveillance.
5.
GMO.
4.
The New World Order.
3.
Rex. 84.
2.
Vaccines.
1.
Synchronicity.
Ignition.
Liftoff. We have liftoff on the Alternate Current Radio Network.
Want to hear the truth from the outer recesses of the human condition on these topics and others affecting your life? This is Cosmic. I strive to find experts in their fields, bringing important information to your corner of the universe. So just stay tuned to the Alternate Current Radio Network at alternatecurrentradio.com. Look under Latest Radio Archives and scroll down to Cosmic's Corner of the Universe on the Alternate Current Radio Network.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Patrick Henningsen. Welcome to the Sunday Wire. We're streaming out live on the ACR network. That's the Alternate Current Radio Network.com and 21st Century Wire.com. You can listen to the live stream now and also the recording of this show and on the archives after the show, probably a couple of hours after. So do revisit the show page. We're back, and I've got my first guest connected on the line. Of course, we introduced him last week. His name is Kurt Haskell. He's a former U.S.-based attorney who was witness to the famous underwear bomber false flag event. Well, we're calling it a false flag event because it's certainly what it looks like, and also it's certainly based on what Kurt has said and said publicly. Also testified, it looks like a staged terror event designed to create some kind of political inertia for some policies that were pushing behind that event. And Kurt told us about that last week. We brought him back this week because we found that there was just not enough time last week. But there's a lot of details that Kurt has looked at the Paris event, which he's going to share with us. I've got notebooks full of notes I've taken on this Paris attack as well. So we're going to try to compare notes here and try to scratch the surface. Now, Stuart Hooper's introduction before the break, which was based on the article that he wrote, was excellent in sort of setting up this segment. So I brought back Kurt. Kurt, how you doing?
Hey, good. How are you, Patrick?
I'm great. I'm great, Kurt, and I'm really glad you joined us again. This is a very deep subject. It's vast. then the amount of detail and the various facets of this particular terror event in Paris is different than previously terror events. A lot more information came out in waves. We had a lot of media activity that was coalescing around various talking points in real time. And it's stuff that I'm not saying it's anything new. I've seen it before, but how they rolled it out this time in the media was very organized, almost as if it was all ready to go from central planning, and they were just releasing stuff on sort of every hour, and they had a series of stuff that they wanted to put out in certain order so that a certain narrative or story was formed, or mythology, if you will, if you want to go that far. Was formed to describe this event and give it to the public. And, of course, we have the latter part of the Hegelian dialectic, which is the solution. So we have problem, we have public reaction, we have solution. The solutions, are, of course, came out in President Obama and David Cameron's speech yesterday, announcing tough new cybersecurity laws to combat terrorism and other measures, draconian measures, I would probably describe some of them as, using this event as an opportunity to ram through various policies, like the Patriot Act was rammed through in the media aftermath of 9/11, and we're still stuck with it today. So they don't repeal these things when they come in. When the laws and regulations and the police state measures come in, they do not get rolled back. They're permanent, and that's, to me, a very disturbing part of the whole story. But so going back to the initial event, Kurt, I want you to tell us your observations in this, and also I want you to also compare the sort of setup of the MO. We have patsies, informants, dupes, and other useful idiots, as Stuart Hooper described before the break. I want you to compare and contrast with Detroit and look at some of the other terror events. But what were some of the things when you started really looking into the Paris attacks? What were some of the things that you've really, you're going to zero in on here?
Well, the first thing that really stuck out to me was the dropped identification card in a car.
Yeah.
Now, that just does not happen. I'm sorry. You know, when you go through and plan an attack like this in the obvious detail that they did, well, not only do you not drop your identification, you don't bring it with you at all. There's no need. There's no need for it at all. I mean, look at what they did to conceal their identities, dressing in balaclavas head to toe, right? But they bring their ID card.
Firstly, I'll just interrupt you quickly. I'll let you continue. But how many people out there, raise your hand, or whatever, 15,000 listeners this week, raise your hand and tell us who has ever dropped their ID on their car seat, just their ID. Raise your hand, please. I'm looking out at the classroom. I don't see any hands raised. Okay, go ahead, Kurt.
Right, so that one stuck out like a sore thumb. And then, of course, what did that remind me of? Well, 9/11, right? When there were one or two passports found in the burning rubble of the World Trade Center, undamaged.
Yeah.
It just happened to point to mysterious Muslim attackers that there's no evidence of that they existed.
Yeah, Muhammad Atta, the Egyptian-born supposed hijacker, his passport was found in mint condition in the rubble of the World Trade Center.
Right.
You know, the plane was supposedly vaporized. No fuselage, no plane evidence could be found, but yet this passport was produced. Okay.
So that's immediately what I thought of. So, you know, I saw that and I started thinking, well, the same people are behind this one that were involved in that one. And, you know, they're using the same old tricks. And we've seen it throughout the Paris attack, same old tricks and conflicting stories. You know, something else that really sticks out to me is the shooters were white. And if you look closely at the videos of the two shooters, well, they have very large eye holes, and in some shots you can see the color of their neck, the skin on their neck, and they're very clearly white. Or if you're playing devil's advocate and say, well, they're very light-skinned Arabs, well, then you have to compare to the still pictures that were released in the gas station robbery on day two, where Sharif Kouachi looks practically like a black man. He's so dark, he looks like a black man.
Mm-hmm.
And if you compare that picture the next day to the picture the day before, where you see the eye holes and the neck color, which is clearly white, it's practically impossible unless Sharif Kouachi went to a tanning bed those 24 hours between the two pictures and just laid in the bed, you know, at high temperature.
So what you're saying, Kurt, there is that it's pretty probable that these shooters that were shown in these supposed amateur videos that were released are probably, they couldn't possibly be the same people in some of the subsequent photographs that were released. And, of course, there was no chain of custody with these suspects. They disappeared twice within the sort of timeline. So it's pretty probable that we're talking about different people, right?
I would say it's impossible.
Yeah.
It's not impossible that the Kouachi brothers were the shooters, but it's impossible that the shooters were the two people that appeared in the gas station robbery surveillance photo the next day.
Yeah.
That was subsequently deemed to be the Kouachis, who were then chased to the printing company where they supposedly died in a shootout.
Yeah.
So that, to me, that is impossible if you look at the difference in skin color. And just for the record, it's impossible if you say, well, maybe the taller shooter was white, but the younger one could have been dark. Well, no, because Saeed Kouachi is 5'6.5". So,
oh, no kidding.
He's very short. So when you look at the taller shooter, it's very obvious that he was white. Yeah. So that would have to be Sharif Kouachi, who's approximately 5'9". And if you look at the picture of him the next day, he's obviously, he could be considered an African-American. He's so dark in that picture. So it's impossible.
Mm-hmm.
So that was something that else that really stuck out to me in my long list of anomalies in this event. But those two are extremely obvious to me.
Yeah, absolutely. And the other thing that you mentioned there with these two brothers, possibly I would like to know, you know, forensically, what are the heights of these two brothers? Are they the same height? Most likely they are. If they're close in age and they're brothers, they're probably, and they're very short. There's that. There's also evidence you would have also bullet holes in the pavement, perhaps. When the Parisian police officer was supposedly shot, this is the famous no blood video that was circulating on the internet. You've seen that aspect of this, right?
Oh yeah, I've looked at pretty much every aspect of the shooting in detail, because once I see something that doesn't make sense, then I really dig into it. So yeah, I don't know what to make out of that video, because you have the brothers stop their car. Well, first of all, I have to go back a couple steps. They're escaping from the shooting. They already had the shooting at Charlie Hebdo. They've gotten in two shootouts with other police cars. They drive five blocks. They're going very slow in their car. They stop in the middle of the road, get out, walk, and shoot a cop on a sidewalk who has no gun. Now, what kind of sense does that make? Wouldn't they just keep driving and try and escape? You know, you're giving other police supposedly more time to swarm you, right? I mean, a few seconds can be the difference between you getting away or not. So, you know, and then they walk up to this guy. The video shows one shot. There's no movement of the body at the time the bullet would have hit the body. There's no jerk of the head. There's no blood. There's nothing. The angle of the bullet doesn't look like it hit the body. It looks like it went over the top of the body. There's no damage to the cement underneath. And then when you look the next day at the blood stains on the sidewalk, they're about 10 feet away from where the man was shot. If you look at the sidewalk and the spot where the man was shot, there's no blood stain at all. You know, it's very, very suspect. And then there was a video of a reporter the next day saying, see this blood spot? This was put here. What do you make out of that? It was put there. That's not the kind of word I would use. I would say, you know, this is blood that, you know, came out of the body yesterday of the police officer that was shot, something like that. I wouldn't say it was put there. Very suspect language. So, yeah, that shooting is very, very suspect. But unfortunately, the video is not clear enough, I don't think, to tell us whether he was actually shot or not. So I think that's one of those points that's going to be argued back and forth till the end of time. He was shot. He wasn't shot. He's dead. He's not dead.
Yeah.
There are better points to make in this France false flag than that one. That one will be argued till the end of time, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the other thing that stuck out to me is if this is a French police officer, does he not have a firearm? He's just sitting there on the ground saying, oh, please don't shoot. And then they supposedly pop him with a bullet or a blank or whatever it was. And does he not have a firearm? I mean, because if I was shot and wounded, basically all bets are off. I'm going to take out some assailants, basically. With my firearm. I'm not just going to sit there and say, oh, please don't shoot. You know, that seemed really weird to me.
Well, I don't think this one had a firearm for whatever reason. I don't know. But then it begs the question, why don't you just pull up alongside of him and unload on him?
Yeah. Yeah.
Right? Why do you get out of your car and walk 100 feet or whatever and then shoot him? What kind of sense does that make? He's right on the sidewalk just a couple feet from the road. Pull up next to him. Unload on him from your car.
Yeah. Well, there's a number of better ways to execute that one. I mean,
right.
The other thing is the second video that was released. I think there were some problems with the first video. A lot of people have taken that apart, the one shot from the rooftop. And there was a guy with a bulletproof Kevlar vest up on the roof. This is moments after the attack. I'm like, how is he? Who's this guy up on the roof with a bulletproof vest? Is he media or is he police? How did he get up there so quickly? And it's a supposed amateur video. You have another girl with a clipboard, looks like a script advisor or something like that. She's up on the roof. And that was the original YouTube video from the roof of the attack. Now, that created such a storm, they released a second video. And you could hear them shouting their Islamic slogans from there. I mean, they're shouting Islamic slogans to an empty street, which I thought was weird. It's almost as if they were shouting them just to get them on camera of the second amateur video, supposedly amateur video. And then, so they you've seen the second video, Kurt, where they get out of the car, apparently his gun jammed or something, and the one shooter is helping the other, and the police are blocking the street, and then the police basically reverse down the street all the way, not just block the street, but reverse out to allow them a passageway and exit. So if I was the shooters, I would be either reverse. If the police were at one end, I'd be reversing the car to the other. Or, it's just improbable that the police would allow them an escape and reverse nicely, give them a nice pathway out. And they're saying they were outgunned. The police were outgunned. And I'm sorry, even if the police are outgunned, the police are still going to be shooting or blocking the street and not letting a multi-murderer get away. They police would have known how many people were shot in the office, etc. There's no way they would let these people out.
Right. They could have stopped at the end of that block, blocked the road by putting their car there sideways, taken cover, and got out and shot at their tires.
Easily.
Easily. They did none of that. I don't even think they returned fire at all.
It's suspect. And then the gunman turned their back to the police at one point because he's just like talking to somebody, his partner, looking the other. I mean, you don't, if you're in a fire exchange with police, you just don't stand there, turn your back. I mean, it's all very casual. The whole, kind of blocking of this theatrical scene seemed very casual to me, and I found that very strange. So
it is.
Yeah. So anyway,
and one other really strange aspect, and that's not, I don't see anyone talking about this. The video you're talking about, if you watch the suspects drive towards the police who have gotten into a wreck at the end of the street, the tail end of the video, they turn left. Okay, but on all maps I've seen of what occurred, they turn right there, go to the next street, turn left, and then turn left again, and they would be then close to where the police car is, but on the opposite side of this divided road, heading in the opposite direction, which is where they encounter the police officer walking on the left, on the sidewalk on the left. So my point being, If everyone's following me here, it's kind of confusing. If they would have turned left, Okay, then they would have had to make two rights to get to where they shot the police officer walking on the street, a right at the next road and then another right. But the problem with that is then they would have encountered the police officer walking on the right side of their car, which they didn't do. So the only possible way that they encountered the officer walking on the left side of the car was we saw them turning left. They would have had to have made a U-turn and gone back past the wrecked cop car. That's the only way. And then made the two lefts to encounter that officer on the sidewalk on their left walking. It makes no sense at all. They're going to go make a U-turn after they just got in a shootout with these cops who they know are sitting at that intersection?
Yeah.
Again, how does that happen? How do they encounter this cop walking on the street then? Because it's not believable.
Well, it happened if, in fact, the police are standing down and kind of letting them go into their choreographed, pre-choreographed positions to carry out the kind of visual terror attack, if you will. If they're being allowed to do that, then it makes perfect sense, Kurt.
Right. But if you think about it, where is the map showing the U-turn? And then them going back around. Nobody put out a map like that. But it's very obvious in that video that they turned left there.
Well, you're not going to want to put that map out because a lot of people are going to ask a lot of questions.
That's something about the video that I haven't seen anybody talk about. How does that happen? How did they turn left there and then, get on the opposite side of the divided road heading the other direction? Makes no sense at all.
Yeah.
So, I almost wonder if the shooting of the cop on the sidewalk was, like, pre-filmed or something, because it just doesn't make sense at all.
Yeah, well, the order in which the events happened, you'd have to sort of determine all of this. I mean, you're talking about looking at this forensically, and this is something that it's almost, and this is one of the interesting things about this particular terror attack event, is that there's no, and others as well, there's no interest from the media or at least from what I'm hearing from law enforcement as they're speaking to the media, there's no interest in the forensics of what happened because we're not allowed to sort of raise any questions about anything that's going on. Even, of course, more than anything, the guilt of the supposed suspects or whether they're actually the perpetrators, the chain of custody of them, of the evidence, of the whole scene, the forensics of it, the timeline, who, what, when, where. We're not meant to question or look into any of that. It's almost as if none of that matters. It's a crime scene, but we're not very interested at all in the forensics because if there's any third parties involved, and it's shown that there are any third parties involved in these events, obviously then the whole thing collapses like a house of cards. So that's I'm interested in the forensics of it, of course. It's a crime scene. If I was investigating it, I'd want to work out, before I start speculating about terror cells and, terrorism and this and that, I'd want to know the forensics of what happened.
Well, exactly. But that's something we see in all these fake terrorist attacks. There's Patsy's named right away. Their pictures are put all along the media. We're told what happened, and then they're killed off, and that's the end of the story. And then that story just keeps getting repeated till the end of time. Nobody looks into the details after that. Exactly what we have here. Exactly.
And here's another one that I thought was interesting that I think it was originally incredibly, one journalist from BFMTV in France, CNN describes this as their affiliate in France. I thought that was interesting. I didn't realize CNN had affiliates, but there you go. BFMTV, this one journalist magically made contact with all three gunmen at the same time, right before they bit the dust, and they all each spilled the beans about who they're working for to provide the sort of missing pieces to the story, if you will. One single French journalist managed to talk on the phone. I find this incredible. And one of them, I think it was Sharif Kouachi, said, Sharif Kouachi, I'm quoting him, me, Sharif Kouachi, traveled to Yemen. That sounds a lot like, hello, This is Barbara Olson. You know, I'm in one of the airliners here, and we've been hijacked. You know, who would say their full name on a telephone call unless it was pre-recorded and they wanted to get the name in the recording so that it provided piece of the narrative? So he says he went to Yemen, and Anwar al-Awlaki paid for this his trip and this operation and whatnot, and that was immediately after the event. So then we find out that later that Sharif Kouachi had his passport revoked because of the felony charges and the prison time he did. So he couldn't have possibly traveled to Yemen. So they made up the story immediately, put this in the media, that he used his brother Saeed Kouachi's passport to travel to Yemen. Now, how on earth could, if I used my brother's passport to go to another country, and I went back and came back and I returned, how would anyone know I was using my brother's passport if I made it through customs four times?
Right, they wouldn't know.
They wouldn't
know. Not only that, the two brothers don't look alike at all.
Yeah.
And there's a considerable height difference of about 2.5 inches.
But even if they did, even if they were identical twins or looked very much alike, there's no way you could know if someone traveled on someone else's passport unless they were stopped.
Right.
And
there's no way.
Yeah.
There's no way.
So
unless you had video of it, but, you know, there's a video of them going through customs or something, but they're not going to be able to find that so quickly in their records. I'm sorry. It's not going to happen.
So that sounds like a patch that they had to put out in the press to basically fill that anomaly, this bad part of the story they've constructed. They made a mistake, so they put this out as a patch saying, oh, no, he used his brother's passport. You know, it's things like that that just stick out to me as glaringly obvious. And there's a number of these sort of various updates. The girlfriend, Hayat Boumediene, I think her name is. I can't pronounce her name, but the supposed, they're calling her the ISIS trophy wife now. And so she disappeared off the scene. She was supposed to be in the kosher grocery store. How did the reports come about that she was inside initially? And then we find out, oh, she's left. She's gone to Turkey on January 2nd, just days before the terror attack. She fled to Turkey, and she's the world's most wanted woman. But wanted for what? We don't know. It looks to me like she was, a lot of times, Kurt, and this might sound a little bit cloak and dagger, but when people are picking up all the various chatter and information is being thrown around, phone calls, eyewitness, you know, this gunman, Koulabi, the African-French gunman in the kosher grocery store, most likely would have had it seems to me like he was either an informant or a patsy, would have had a handler. Normally the female is the handler, the girlfriend or the wife would be the handler in some of these cases. So I think she got picked up by law enforcement as an accomplice or spotted, and then they had to kind of get rid of her. She's probably, she could very well be an informant or a person of interest who's helping to stage manage this thing, and then they've disappeared her. Basically, they released a photo or a video of her at an airline desk saying this is when she fled to Turkey. She's wearing a veil, you can't ID her, and she's with a young gentleman who no one's asking who this guy is, you know, and they're supposedly picking this apart with a fine-tooth comb. And who's her accomplice there, the most wanted woman in the world? No one dares to ask who's the guy standing next to her. He's easy to ID. He's not wearing a veil or a mask. You know, you could easily ID this person, right? So to me, it's very very fishy, this whole story of the terror bride.
Well, yeah, it is. There's even more to it than that, though. Remember, the police, to even get on the trail of Koulibaly, the kosher grocery store hostage taker, he crashed a car. Okay, well, there were three car wrecks in this story, two by the Kouachis, one by Koulibaly. But that's very suspect, too. But anyway.
Go ahead.
So he crashes his car. No one even knows who he is at this point. The police approach him, supposedly see all these weapons in his car, and he shoots a policewoman and escapes and goes into the kosher grocery store. Okay, whatever. So you're telling me, and there were eyewitnesses to this account, you're telling me that the eyewitnesses couldn't tell if he had a woman accomplice with him or not at the shooting? I mean, how hard is it to tell between a single man and a woman? Not very hard, I don't think. So we have that, and then we have the accounts of her being in the kosher grocery store with him, yet police have admitted that they hacked into the security cameras of the kosher grocery store, yet the pictures that were released don't show her in there at all. You know, all accounts by the witnesses say there was only Koulibaly there. So this is very, very questionable. You know, and then pictures of her being released, like pointing a crossbow at a camera, very, very inflammatory pictures. So how does this all come about? And then an arrest warrant is issued for her. She's not just wanted. This was put before a judge with some sort of evidence that issued an arrest warrant for her for the murder of the policewoman when she wasn't even in the country. So it's beyond, her role is beyond fishy here some way. It's either what you said, that she was kind of a handler, or the other possibility is that she's being kind of built up in the media here for a future event where we're going to see her making like terrorist type bin Laden-esque videos, you know, being released, taunting the U.S., that sort of thing, from Syria or wherever the U.S. wants to invade at that particular moment, Yemen, something like that. It's one or the other. I'm not sure at this point. I don't know that anybody is, but she has some sort of role here, a very suspect one.
Yeah, we're looking at this, at least I am, in terms of this is kind of a new kind of breed or a new narrative of modern 21st century terror, which is really a throwback to the 1970s, which I call the Gilded Age of political terrorism in Europe, in the Middle East, with you know, Carlos the Jackal and all the various splinter groups of the PLO and the Palestinian Liberation Front and the Bader-Meinhofer gang in Germany, and members going from group to group, basically moving from group to group because you know, different going from one terrorist group to the next like it's a nightclub. And the characters were put out in the media, very romanticized. Of course, you had communist themes woven into that, socialist themes woven into those characters and their terrorist groups and so forth. And it was all very stage managed. We find out later, many of them were working or managed by people working under Operation Gladio. During the 1960s, 70s, and 80s in Europe, which was a CIA-funded and NATO intelligence-run series of false flag events designed to herd public opinion or to determine the outcome of various elections or to minimize certain groups, especially heavily socialist parties in places like Italy and also Belgium, as it turns out. So that's part of history, Kurt. That's not theory. That's actual history. And as more declassified documents come out in future years, eventually the truth will eventually come out about many of these so-called terrorist events that were in fact stage managed in order to herd the public and also to provide the padding for policies and for the introduction of new regulations, for instance. So that's what I see here with this event. It's just the latest, more colorful version, which is hearkening back to the 70s.
Yeah, I would happen to agree. You know, they're doing all these events to change public opinion in order to pass laws and invade different countries and for policy reasons. But, you know, they're becoming so obvious, and there are so many of these that more and more people are understanding what's going on here, especially with the internet and people more aware of this sort of thing than, say, back in 2001 when we had 9/11. Well, now, you know, immediately people are digging into every little detail of the event, which we didn't really have back in 2001. It took years for it to slowly kind of drip out what happened back then. But now it's immediate.
Yeah, and it's all, in terms of the geopolitics of the situation, all the sort of pointers are pointing right now at Yemen. So I was going to say Yemen will probably be perhaps the next place for military intervention from the United States or from a NATO coalition. And they'll use these attacks this week, the last 2 weeks, as the sort of pretext for some sort of military intervention in Yemen. And if you look at the map and you look at the position of Yemen, of course, this is right across from Iran. Strategically, there is no more important position than Yemen in terms of the choking point there at the Arabian Sea and the Persian Gulf. So I think that's on the cards probably sooner than later. We might see that being the case. And, of course, this will be Paris will be the rallying cry for that particular intervention. But Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, 2 days into the last week, there's a video that was released. It's almost as if they named Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. That was then validated by a journalist called Jeremy Scahill, who works for The Intercept. And he validated the claim of one of the Kouachi brothers to the French journalist. So it's a series of validations. And then we have the video from Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, a nicely produced green screen video of someone with a beard and a turban claiming credit for these attacks. It's almost like they didn't have the video ready and they had to kind of get it ready in the right order of time. And they produced this video, so it all fits together for the media. It's an unbelievable series of events. It's unbelievable because it is unbelievable, Kurt. I don't believe it.
Right. I don't either. To me, this is one of the most obvious false flags, if not the most obvious. Once you get into the little details of this, none of it makes sense. And I would agree Yemen will probably be attacked soon because of the shouts by the shooters saying, hey, we're Al-Qaeda from Yemen. I mean, who does that? I mean, it's one thing to say we're from Al-Qaeda, which I don't think they would even do that, but then to specify what country they're from, oh, come on.
And then
give me a break.
Yeah, and the media then took that, and then that launched a new series of talking points across media, which is there's a deadly rivalry that's taking place. Is Al-Qaeda in Yemen, AQA in the Arabian Peninsula, are they competing with ISIS for the headlines? What a chilling development, Wolf. And then you get Blitzer talking back and forth with Bob Baer or one of these ex-CIA operatives who are national security experts on the networks. And so they're building up this narrative. There's this rivalry. And could there be a tit-for-tat to grab the headlines from these competing terrorist groups? Oh, my God, what a horrible prospect. But they're getting you to believe this. And that's another layer of unbelievability, in my opinion, that they're getting people to buy into.
Yeah, it's just ridiculous. I mean, they go through all this process to conceal their identities, but then they say, hey, we're Al-Qaeda from Yemen. Yeah. And by the way, you know, we didn't bring enough money with us, so tomorrow we need to rob a gas station, but we're not going to conceal our identities anymore. And you know, we didn't even bring enough money with us to buy food and gas the next day. I mean, come on. This is like a bad movie plot, really bad one.
Yeah, it's like a 7-7. You know, you get the supposed 7-7 bombers buying return tube tickets. When they get onto the train into London, they get a return ticket. And they get the Super Saver fare, too. which is a bit cheaper, you know, and just like unbelievable. Why would, if you're going on a one-way suicide run, why would you buy a return ticket?
Exactly.
Unless you're on a drill, unless you're going, you're being instructed by a handler on the security services and you're part of a drill. You think you're on some kind of a top secret drill and you're being paid for it perhaps, and you know, you're being managed, and then next thing you know, you're the patsy. You find out and then you're dead, which has happened on so many occasions. So I look at this event being, maybe it was just because this was a little bit complicated, this one, and maybe some things didn't go to plan exactly, and that's why the official, what I call the sweeping up operation, because here's the other thing, Kurt, that first you have the event, then you have the media narrative, and then you have what I call the sweep up operation, which happens mostly in the media. And then we had the Belgium terror raids, which happened a few days ago. And many arrests were made. You know, I don't think there'll be any convictions coming out of any of these arrests, but arrests made in five countries as European security services move in to deal with terrorist cells that were awakened, sleeper cells awakened. How about that for a headline, Kurt? Sleeper cells awakened. I'm reading it right off the TV right now, you know.
So you have to create fear across the globe, right? Not just in France. You might as well use it to the best of your ability, right? To use it for a bigger region. But one thing I wanted to mention, I know we don't have a whole lot of time left, but back to that gas station. Remember, this is day two when the Kouachi brothers were wanted and still at large. Okay, what I found pretty interesting is that when the police announced that they were wanted, they didn't. All they gave out was a headshot of the two of them. They didn't give out any height or weight or body description of either of them at all. Mm-hmm. So when they robbed the gas station, all reports say they were wearing masks. We're told that the gas station owner called in to the police and said, I've been robbed. The two robbers here match the description of the Kouachi brothers. Well, what would that be? Because he said they're wearing masks. What? And there was no description of them released except pictures of their faces. So how could that be? How could that be? And then when the actual still pictures of the robbery are released almost a week later,
yes,
it shows two men that really don't compare very well to the pictures of the Kouachi brothers at all. And to me, it doesn't look like either one. So it just doesn't add up at all. And it's really suspect that they didn't release the height and weight of the wanted men. And I think the reason for that is the shooters were different than the height and weight of the Kouachi brothers.
Yes.
I think it's as simple as that.
Yes.
Yes.
And they herded them into a secure location, which is this supposed printing workshop in the French village, it's about 40 miles outside of Paris or something like that, and a totally secure location. And I was doing the live feed to our readers as it was happening, so we're staying up overnight during the actual attack, just basically feeding out all the stuff which is coming off the AFP, Associated France Press Newswire. And they had, once the shooters were pinned down, supposedly, in this printing workshop, police then were herding the journalists. You have to imagine the scene, Kurt. You have law enforcement and hundreds of journalists and law enforcement converging on this little French village in a matter of minutes. And so they had all the media herded over approximately 300 to 400 meters on a hillside, 300 to 400 meters on the other side of the road, which split where this warehouse was. And then so the police had full hermetically sealed this site, basically. And so then they could release what was released to the media from that supposed standoff was pretty much wasn't any press or media. It was stuff that was released supposedly by employees who work there or by the police. We don't know for sure. And so we didn't see this, how this thing went down, and no one saw how this thing went down except for the police themselves. So, and they said that this was for the public safety, of course. I found that whole thing very contrived. I'm thinking, why did they stop there? Why did they end up there? First it was a chase through the woods earlier that morning or late the night before. There, the police are converging on the forest to find these terrorists, the Kouachi brothers. So that was interesting. Then they, next thing you know, they're in the village. I don't know. It seemed like a perfect way to kind of manage the whole thing cleanly.
Yeah, I think so too. You know, and then we have, of course, the two surviving witnesses, one of them being released by the Kouachi brothers, supposedly. You know, and he tells the story of him giving them coffee and dressing their wounds and then them being nice and letting him go. It's nonsense. And the other guy hid in a box and was texting to the police what was going on. Come on. Is this a movie or what is it? You know, but you mentioned the chase through the forest. Well, how did the police get back on their trail to chase them through the forest? Well, look, there was another car mishap. This time they got stuck in the mud and had to hijack yet another car. But did they kill the driver of that car? No. They just told him they were there to avenge the prophet and then let him go. Oh, of course. Which let him go report this to the media, right? I mean, come on. Yeah, okay.
Can I have your car? I'm sorry. We're here to avenge your prophet. We got to go. We've got the sort of cops on our tail. But, hey, we're here to avenge the prophet. Could you get that down, please? And off we go. Off we go to the next stage of the cannonball run through France. I mean, it is a kind of a incredible story, and it's like, you know, these things are fine in Hollywood films and television, but in the real world, I just have a problem. You can kind of spot when something's a staged managed narrative versus a real narrative, and there's so many aspects of this that are staged managed. I mean, have you got a couple extra minutes, Kurt? Because I know you've got some other stuff.
Yeah.
What were some of the other exhibits? Let's call this exhibit number four. Mm-hmm. What have you got for us?
Well, okay. When the shooters went into the Charlie Hebdo offices, remember they're having a board meeting with only about, I think, 10 employees present.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and in a small room. There are conflicting accounts by two of the witnesses that are there. One of them says that there was one man, he came in, opened the door to our meeting, and just started shooting everybody. And then there is another report that says two men came in, they read off a list of names, separated the men from the women, and precisionally shot the people who were on the list and not the other people. So how, with a traumatic event like this in a small room with a small amount of people, could there be two completely different accounts of what happened? And the man, interestingly enough, the man that said there was only one shooter and he just shot up the entire room, put particular emphasis on the fact that the magazine was going to go on and they're going to keep printing it. Now, to me, if I had just been through this event, that would be the last thing on my mind. I'd be, you know, I would be probably in shock, you know, and thankful I'm still alive and probably not want to deal with anyone for quite some time, maybe get some medication. But this guy's worrying about the magazine still being printed. It just, it boggles the mind.
Well, and they had the Twitter campaign was rolled out approximately about 3 hours after the event. They had Je Suis Charlie, and the magazine had supposedly made this graphic, which was done in the kind of illustrative style, Je suis Charlie, I am Charlie, and that sort of went global within a couple of hours. Now, again, if I was an employee of this magazine and this happened, the last thing I would be doing is a Twitter campaign and slogans and graphics to sort of symbolize the tragedy. That would be kind of maybe something a couple of days later that you might start thinking about as the tragedy site, the loss of life, loss of colleagues and all this, is as that kind of sinks in. It might take you, okay, well, be generous, Kurt, 24 hours. 24 hours just to let it soak in. No, within 3 hours.
Right. It's also very suspicious that this magazine was having severe financial problems and was close to bankruptcy, selling only 45,000 copies a week, and then this week alone they sold 5 million copies. Not only that, but they have donations pouring in from major corporations around the globe and various governments to the tune of millions of dollars. very suspicious to me. It reminds me of Sandy Hook, that Sandy Hook shooting where I forget the amount, but I think it was to the tune of $45 million
Wow.
was sent to Newtown, Connecticut by the United States government and various other corporations after the shooting. It almost seems like a payoff for a job well done to me.
Yeah, and I know that wasn't to repair the school because, of course, they bulldozed it.
right.
The crime scene's gone. If anyone wants to go and actually investigate that one, it's history. It's been flattened. Go ahead, Kurt.
I was just going to say, too, of course, remember, Charlie Hebdo is a magazine that some would say is very anti-Muslim and that never prints cartoons that are anti-Israeli or anti-Jewish. So there's that angle, too. I don't really want to get into that, but it would seem that there would be some payoffs, possibly, maybe, to keep this anti-Muslim publication going. So there's that aspect, too. Very, you know, there's no proof of this, but it's certainly suspect.
They go on. What's one of the big talking points is that, oh, Charlie Hebdo offends everybody. And first of all, I have to question in a publication whose only real contribution to society is to stir up ethnic conflict and, you know, to divide communities. I'm going to question, you know, the whole basis of that publication, what their mission is. But they say we're equal opportunity offenders. Well, I'm looking at some of their covers, and there's a few. Obviously, they've shown the Prophet Muhammad, and that's, created a huge upswell of protests from the Muslim communities worldwide and in France. And then bashing the Pope, a lot, with a lot of homosexual depictions of the Pope and other sort of really just very bad taste, disgusting, I would class it as, basically. But there's not a whole lot really going after, I would say, Israel bashing the so-called Jewish community. Okay, now there's a reason for that, because they did do a, back in, I believe it was 2009, Sarkozy's brother, they did a bashing of him and his Jewish wedding. He's marrying into some big money. They made light of it, and the editor was forced to resign as a result and make a public apology to the Jewish community. So this free speech argument about Charlie Hebdo doesn't swing both ways with regards to the Muslim community or the Jewish community. So it makes me think, is there an agenda there? Is Charlie Hebdo playing a role in a bigger narrative? It's certainly worth asking.
Yes, I agree. Especially with these huge donations rolling in this week from governments and major corporations, it makes you think that they want this sort of publication to keep going. Now, what if it was reversed and it was a very anti-Semitic, anti-Israel publication? Would we have seen the same? I would say probably not.
It's not going to get $50 million from the French government.
Exactly. It's not going to get anything. So that, you know, kind of makes me wonder, you know, who's behind this attack. But that's very, you know, we have better proof on some other things.
Yeah.
That's kind of a very arguable point. But one other thing I wanted to mention, when we see the video of the shooters driving away, they're driving very, very slow. I would say maybe 30 kilometers an hour, 20 miles an hour, something like that. Yet we're told just a mile away, they crashed their car so badly that it's not drivable anymore. And when you see the pictures of it, about all there is to it is a small dent and a broken window. That's it. But remember, the things that the police found in the car allowed them to identify the shooters. And without the abandoned car, they would not have been able to identify the shooters, which was where they found the identification of one. And then the other brother's fingerprint on a Molotov cocktail that was left behind. So it's very, very suspicious why this car was even abandoned, or how it had even gotten into a wreck going at such a low speed. And then we see the pictures where it's really not damaged that badly at all. So it's very, very, very suspicious.
Did you see as well, Kurt, that with regards to Amedi Coulibaly, the kosher grocery store gunman, they had announced 24 hours after that they've done a DNA match, and it is indeed Coulibaly. And so I have to ask the question, did they, A, have his DNA already on, you know, when you do a DNA match, it means you've got something previously, you know, on record, and then you're taking something new, and you're matching the two. That's my understanding of it. So why would they announce that is one thing, unless they're trying to shore up a story that they know is very shaky.
Right. Where did they get the DNA to match it? I don't know. He didn't, to my knowledge, he did not have an arrest record.
No, he did.
Coulibaly? Oh, no, he did.
Yeah, Coulibaly has got a very interesting record, actually. So Coulibaly was basically did jail time, and then he was released from jail in 2009, and then 4 or 5 months after his initial release, he, by the way, he had supposedly met the Kouachi brothers, or one of them, in prison, and they radicalized together. This is all recorded by French authorities, by the way, so this wasn't an unknown person. And then he meets President Sarkozy, has this kind of jobs for young, disaffected youths, and Coulibaly supposedly got a job at a Coca-Cola bottling factory in his hometown. And then Sarkozy at the presidential palace, at Elysee Palace in Paris, showed off Coulibaly and some other youth as the face of the new young French getting back on their feet, which I thought was interesting because he would have been vetted to go, and obviously someone on record already is being radicalized in prison. And so magically, a couple of months after the Sarkozy a meeting, they arrest Coulibaly at his flat with 240 rounds of high-powered ammunition and photographs with one of France's most well-known terror figures. And then he was put into prison. Then he gets fingered for helping to plot the escape of another of France's well-known terror figures. He's given a 5-year sentence in 2013 and is somehow allowed to walk with an ankle tag a couple of months after, and then they cut off the ankle tag in May, and that's the same time they supposedly stopped surveillance of these two terror suspects in June of 2014, and that leads us up to last week's 2 weeks events. So if you had anybody who was the perfect patsy or informant in terms of his pedigree, it would be Amedi Coulibaly.
Right, and these would be the exact sort of people that would be tracked full-time. You wouldn't stop tracking these people. If you're not tracking these people, who are you tracking?
And the plot he was involved with, Kurt, was none other than the plot to blow with the guy who he was photographed with, who was his supposed friend, was the one who wanted to blow up the U.S. Embassy in Paris. Now, come on. Then you've got the U.S., whole intelligence apparatus in the frame, okay? So I just don't buy it.
Which monitors everybody all the time, but suddenly they quit watching this guy 6 months ago.
Well, here's the crux of the matter, Kurt. Okay, this leads us to the next piece of interesting evidence. Now, this was discovered by Sean Helton, who writes for 21st Century Wire, noted that 10 days ago, U.S. authorities claimed that a U.S. database for terrorists called the Terrorist Identities Data Mart Environment, or TIDE, they like their acronyms, so TIDE, T-I-D-E, so had been tracking the shooters said to be involved in the Charlie Hebdo attacks and had placed at least one of them, I believe Sharif Kouachi, on a no-fly list for the United States, if not the other two. So it's worth noting that the TIDE database sounds identical to how many experts and whistleblowers have also described Al-Qaeda, the term Al-Qaeda, which itself translates in Arabic to the base or the database. In fact, many whistleblowers, including former British Foreign Secretary Robin Cook, who said this publicly, that Al-Qaeda was a database used to track and manage Islamic fighters used by Western intelligence agencies to carry out covert operations and false flag attacks worldwide in places like Afghanistan, Bosnia, and so forth. And Robin Cook, of course, turned up dead very shortly after saying this in public. He was in line to perhaps challenge Tony Blair for the Labour Party leadership before he died, very well respected Robin Cook. So this tide, this database, that now we're getting into the real, this is the Hall of Mirrors, Kurt. We're in here because this is the official admission that they have this database, that they do track people constantly in real time from point to point using all the various digital dragnet technologies and things that the NSA and the U.S. government and European authorities have at their fingertips. And then we have a term like Al-Qaeda, which means database, and we can go back and look at the lineage and the pedigree of this whole setup. And these are these new actors who have come into the fore in this event. And, of course, yes, they were being tracked. They were on no-fly lists, and they were being monitored before these attacks took place. So why weren't they stopped then?
Right. Why weren't they stopped? That is the question.
Yes.
Right. So, you know, which ties them into the underwear bomber case, where we had a similar type patsy that was known, that was allowed to proceed with, however, he had an intentionally defective bomb. So we have to ask the question here, did people really die in the Charlie Hebdo shootings? And I still have a question whether they did or they didn't.
Yeah.
I really do.
Short of going and basically, what would happen if, as a journalist, I'd arrive in Paris and I'd want to speak to the coroner? Would I allowed to be able to visit the morgue, speak to the coroner, look at the autopsies of all the people involved? Would I be allowed to do that, or would that be sealed under a national security letter? That's the question. I think it would be classified, if I'm not mistaken. If anybody knows otherwise, please let us know. But my understanding is that this is classified as a matter of national security. So therefore, could an independent investigation take place? The answer is probably no. That was the answer that Tony Blair gave when an independent inquiry was requested for the 7/7 bombings in London. No, we have to just move on. The nation needs to heal. There will be no independent inquiry into the 7/7 attacks. Are you kidding me? The biggest terrorist event on British soil, and there's going to be no independent criminal or inquiry investigation at all? That's what happened.
Right, and that's always the response. We just need to move on. But then it leaves all of these questions lingering until the end of time. So, no, we don't need to move on. We need questions answered, and then we can move on. But the questions are never actually answered. But getting back to your point about the shooters being on the database, mm-hmm. Well, that begs the question, how did Hamid Mourad get listed as a suspect in this case, the 18-year-old who intelligently turned himself into police right away?
For his own safety.
For his own safety. Now, all the media will not report it that way. They'll report that wanted man Hamid Mourad turns himself in, period. Mm-hmm. No explanation that he was in school at the time of the shootings and could not have been involved, and no questions in regard to how he was listed as a suspect in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they give us reasons why the other two brothers were listed. Well, we found an identification card, and then we found a fingerprint on a Molotov cocktail. Not really believable, but they give us no explanation at all how Hamid Mourad was listed as a suspect when the shooting clearly only shows two shooters. So I'm having a hard time figuring out how he fits into this puzzle.
Yeah, how did he get named in the first place? Exactly the same question we asked earlier about the supposed female accomplice of Coulibaly, Hayat Boumadin. How did she get named and as an original assailant, accomplice to a police shooting or whatever? How did that happen? Where did the name come from? Where did it originate from? And, of course, these are people who weren't even present, weren't connected at all. So
right. And, you know, I did an internet search for Hamid Mourad. There are no pictures of him on the internet anywhere. He was listed as a wanted person. No picture or description of him was ever given out. There's no Facebook account. There's no Twitter. There's nothing of this guy. There's no pictures of him at the scene. There's no height or weight description. There's nothing. Mm-hmm. Nothing of this guy. Which is very questionable. Especially of an 18-year-old kid, you know, you would think he would have some sort of, Facebook account or something like that, Twitter. I don't know.
And the other thing that we have to just also point out here is, how is it possible, Kurt, that so soon after the event, and I've seen this with other terror events, it's almost like it's there's a formula here, there's a sort of set template, if you will, that as if by magic, we have these incriminating photos that come out after the event. So female, fully covered with a burqa on, you can't see anything but her eyes, holding a crossbow, a paintball gun, and Coulibaly the same, and this and the videos that come out, the ISIS video. Now, what he has is behind him, they say, and the ISIS flag you can see on the wall. It's not a flag. It's a 8.5 by 11 inkjet printout of an ISIS flag, which is taped to a wall. And he's there with the turban on and the gun resting there exactly in the same way that we've seen other of these supposed after-the-fact terrorist martyrdom videos. Okay. It really begs the question here. I mean, this is incredibly staged. Where does they find the video? Of course they find the video and the photographs, because it's the exact same story we see from previous terror attacks, like someone would set themselves up completely. So it makes me think that this is all kind of pre-rehearsed, pre-done, pre-produced, and then it's rolled out after the attack in a timely fashion in order to create a perfectly packaged story.
Yeah, I would agree. It's just extremely laughable. It's the same things in every one of these events. We see the same kind of nonsense. You know, I'm not convinced Coulibaly was involved in the Hebdo shootings at all. Yet, you know, he comes and calls CNN and admits that he was. And as a co-conspirator, I mean, the purpose of him, in my opinion, was just to tie up loose ends and to not only tie himself to the Hebdo shooting, but tie himself to the Kouachi brothers and to attack a Jewish store, a kosher store, to give this story a little more backing that Israel was not behind it.
Yeah.
That's my taking on him, because most people would think, well, Israel would never, ever shoot Jewish people in a terrorist attack. So it kind of just takes Israel out of the even being questioned as being behind the shooting. When you look at the facts, you have Netanyahu threatening France that if they vote to recognize Palestine as a state, that he'll take grave action against them.
Oh, he said he said that would be a grave mistake and that they would regret it. And they would regret it. That was in November, right. Before Christmas. So and a similar thing happened, Kurt, and we spoke about this last week with Tony Gosling in Norway in, I believe it's 2009, the Anders Breivik shooting, which, you know, all the media had come on the media after this French attack saying this is the deadliest attack on European soil since whatever. No, it wasn't. Breivik, and they totally glossed over and didn't talk about the Norwegian shooting. This was a supposed Freemason and a Zionist named Anders Breivik who went on a shooting spree, killed 70 Norwegian kids who were part of the Young Labor Party movement, who had just announced BDS sanctions against Israel just before. and recognizing the Palestinian state. And lo and behold, very shortly after, you have this massive slaughter. And, of course, the policy and the public opinion changes drastically, and it's almost like people are afraid to talk about Israel and Norway after that. It was quite incredible, much the same way so again, it's marrying this idea of anti-Semitism with criticizing the state of Israel, and these are two different things in a logical person's mind. Israel is a nation state. It has foreign policies. It's responsible for what's going on in Palestine. That's a conversation. Anti-Semitism has nothing to do with that, in my opinion. They're two separate things.
I agree. You know, I can criticize the U.S. government, but that doesn't mean I don't like the American people. They're two different things.
Yeah.
Completely different. I can't stand the policies of the U.S. government, but American people I have no problem with whatsoever. Two different things. Just like Israel and Jewish people. Two
yeah.
different things.
Yeah,
I've criticized one. I have no problem with the other.
Yeah, I've got Israeli. I had Israeli friends in the past and lost touch with them. Have Jewish friends. Have Jewish work colleagues. Get along great. We have a great time. We have a blast. But I can talk about the state of Israel and divorce that from anything to do with Jewish, in my mind or a critical thinker's mind. The people who want to politicize an event like the Paris attacks, and Israel has absolutely hijacked this event. I mean, the prime minister flies in, was not in, by the way, Francois Hollande did not invite him. And a lot of people don't realize this. They had a little bit of a problem between the two when Netanyahu arrived. He was not invited. Hollande did not want him because he knew that they would probably hijack this event, make it an Israeli event. And of course, that's exactly how the U.S. media portrayed it, as an anti-Jewish attack. And wall-to-wall commentators from Israel, various groups and so forth. So then it gets watered down even more in terms of the looking at what really happened, then it becomes, it's an anti-Semitic event, and get on that sort of narrative. So that's exactly what happened. So it obfuscates the real event even more. Another layer has been dumped on top of this event so that it conceals the forensics of what happened on the day, which is what we're interested in looking at. So
yeah, exactly. And interestingly, you mentioned the Norway, the threats from Israel to Norway, and then the shooting where 70 died shortly thereafter. There were also threats towards Malaysia made by Israel. And, of course, we know what happened to Malaysia last year with three planes falling out of the sky.
Oh, yeah. Malaysia is a mortal enemy of the Israeli state because I think what did they do? Malaysia staged a government-sponsored war crimes conference, didn't they?
Yes.
Implicating Israel. And Israel's foreign minister, everybody's basically labeled Malaysia as a terrorist state or persona non grata in their eyes anyway. So that you could say theoretically that there's a target painted on, at least a diplomatic target painted on Malaysia's forehead after
that. Exactly.
So that's,
and of course, then we have missing Malaysian plane MH370, and then we have MH17 shot down over Ukraine, and then we have the most recent one that crashed, and we don't know why that one crashed as of yet. So very suspect, three crashes within a year after the threats made by Israel and after the threats made against France. The day of the terrorist attack was the very same day that Palestine was recognized into the International Criminal Court, the very same day. So I don't think that's a coincidence whatsoever that it was the same day of the Paris shootings.
Yeah, the war of public opinion is of paramount importance for Israel because, as we identified at 21st Century Wire, when I did my New Year's Trends report, we did our forecast for 2015, I said Palestine is rising. And when I say Palestine is rising, I mean that the public opinion globally, being sympathetic towards Palestine, is rising. And it's a trend that you just can't stop. It's inevitable. As younger generations become more politically aware, they're not weighed down with all the old, tired old 20th century mantras and talking points about how we must defend Israel and it's the only democracy in the Middle East. Of course, Israel's not a democracy. It's a democracy for certain people, just like South Africa was a democracy if you're a white South African, but not for everyone else who's in the Bantustans. So young people have realized this. And so Israel is in a war, is an information war with regards to public opinion to try to do as much as they can to characterize Palestinian Arabs as all being terrorists and in many cases almost subhuman. And that's not an exaggeration to anybody who's followed that issue. And you look at some of the statements made and also what's said about Palestinians by Israelis is they're just like insects that they have to sort of exterminate in order to keep and defend Israel. That's not an exaggeration from things that have been told to me by Israelis, but it's a terrorist state. Palestine, they're all terrorists. Hamas is going to overrun us if we don't stop them or kill them or deal with them or whatever. So this public opinion war is number one issue for Israel right now in the 21st century, because they have to hold on to this idea that they are basically being attacked and threatened by the Palestinians when it's actually the other way around.
Right, exactly. And you know what else I find interesting about this point is where else could you threaten someone and then have harm done to that country and then not even be listed as a potential suspect after the event? Only Israel could pull this off with their control of the media. You know, anywhere else, you know, if I were to threaten your family, if you did a certain action and then you took that action and then members of your family died, where would the police go first? They would come look at me as suspect number one. But that's not what we have here. Not only do we have Israel not being questioned immediately, they're not being questioned at all.
Yeah, well, there's a motive. What you're saying, Kurt, is there's a motive there. There's a motive, there's a means. Evidence, we don't know. That's really for law enforcement and police to do. If they're doing their job, they'd be able to work that one out. But there's definitely a motive there, a geopolitical motive. There's definitely the means. There's a number. I think, Kurt, that the Western intelligence agencies are often working together with Israeli intelligence agencies doing joint projects on joint operations. It's very common. But is this a case where someone was working independently? We have NATO intelligence as well. Plus, we have double agents, and we have overlaps. It can get incredibly complex when you get into the nuts and bolts of it. This is cloak and dagger stuff anyway, which happens below the line. But I think we have to consider all possibilities if we're really interested in finding out what really happened. Or if you want to take the official narrative and swallow that pill, go ahead. You're within your right to do that, but I don't think that's going to get you any closer to the truth.
Yeah, I don't either. Because it's so obvious that's not what happened. But you know, when we're talking about suspects of this too, of this also, what do you make out of Obama not going to the meeting of all these heads of state? To me, that says this isn't his deal. It's not his sort of operation, and he's just kind of standing aside. What do you make out of that?
Well, Inga, if I was his advisor, I'd say it's the smartest move he ever made. I wouldn't want to join in on that conclave of political opportunism there with on the Sunday when they had the anti-terror rally and all the leaders are there arm in arm, and you see Netanyahu in the back row fighting to get in the front row, and then he gets in the front row, then you got the Palestinian leader giving him dirty looks from the other side and Merkel in the middle. I mean, it's just comical. They're all out there, all these hypocrites who don't allow press freedom in their own countries, which we listed case by case on 21st Century War. Je suis hypocrite is the article, and that went viral. And a lot of people read that, got great feedback from that. But we just listed, you had the Bahrainian leader there, Saudi Arabian's official was there in that lineup, and all these Turkey, all these countries that routinely jail, flog, beat, and torture journalists, and kill in some cases. And they're all out there saying, oh, press freedom, freedom of expression, give me a break. You know, it's a huge lineup of hypocrites there, plus the United States, and we list all of the attacks on the free press in the U.S., the raid on AP, James Risen, Jeffrey Sterling, and General James Cartwright. Bang, 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 the list is endless. A war and whistleblowing in the United States at the high level of the press. So it was right for us not to send someone there because at least, you know, we can't be called a hypocrite with regards to the Ed Snowden revelations, for instance, and things like that. So, but as far as Obama not being there, it was a great field talking point, which Sean Hannity and Michael Savage dedicated a whole day of their programming to, as we predicted they would. I put a tweet out the day before saying this is what they're going to do for their programs today, and of course they did, which means they're predictable, nothing else. But, so I think, yeah, you're right, Kurt. It could mean that maybe they got wind of this thinking they don't want to be part of it, or it's the other way around. I'm not sure.
Right, right. I mean, what I take out of it, if this was Obama's plot, a CIA plot, he would be there to kind of propagandize the event and blow it out of proportion with the U.S. media. Him setting himself apart from it, not going, tells me that this was not his plot and he was not involved. That's kind of what I take out of it.
Yeah, it could be British NATO intelligence, British intelligence, because you have one of the Kouachi brothers who apparently, according to a UK newspaper, Sharif met with Finsbury Park Mosque and that crew, you know, the Abu Hamza set there in the UK. And that's MI5, basically, Finsbury Park Mosque. They've got their people in there. So that connects them to this attack, potentially, with their informants and various people that go in and out of that little hornet's nest of jihadism in London. So, you know, it doesn't taste like a CIA or a U.S. op. But, you know, it looks so similar, Kurt, to other terrorist events or what we might call false flag events. They have been proven to be false flag events, actually, not conspiracy theory, not speculation, but you look at evidence of some of these events, absolutely. I mean, 7/7 is a perfect example. If anyone has watched The Ripple Effect on the internet, a great film, that's a great introduction to 7/7, that it absolutely cannot have happened the way the official story says it happened. And the same is true here in Paris.
Right. You know, the Paris event has elements of many different attacks, sort of like 9/11, the Boston bombing, the underwear bomber, even Benghazi, you know, with the comparison of that to the Innocence of Muslims video, and this taking place over a cartoon publication, very similar. So you'd have to think that, which, you know, a lot of these plots are CIA plots, but then that begs the question, if the CIA is not involved in this one, are these intelligence agencies all just working hand in hand, and they have this large group of patsies that they've radicalized, and they all just handpick patsies from this group for whatever particular plot is needed when the time is needed? I mean, is that what's going on here?
Could very well be the case. We talked about the database earlier, the TIDE database that the U.S. has. I think it's a multi agency involvement in these kind of operations. There's something. Who knows? We'll talk about that in the next segment with Jay Dyer about the Spectre organization type setup, which from Ian Fleming's novels, which just seems to be actually working in the real world, but quite possibly, Kurt. Quite possibly. There's layers of this onion that we're getting into, and I think we're going to probably find out more as time goes by. It's definitely, this one's not over.
Yeah, for sure. As much as all the heads of state want it to be over. But, you know, what I just question, what's it going to take to break one of these wide open where there's some real reforms against this sort of thing?
Yeah, well, it's going to be disclosure, and it's going to be evidence based. Hopefully, the public opinion is definitely interested in finding out the facts. We know that. It's just a question of how many people, if there's any journalists, like, you know, when a Cy Hirsch, a Seymour Hirsch, or one of these mainstream journalists picks the ball up, then people will obviously give a little more credence to the to alternative evidence, so to speak. So, but it will languish in the alternative media for the time being, and we're happy to, you know, lay this out as a case, as a forensics case. Okay, no speculation here. We do a bit of speculation, but everything that we've mentioned mostly in this segment has been actual physical evidence that one could check and look at and measure. Okay, not it's not conspiracy theory. We're dealing with facts here. So, but Kurt, awesome segment. I really appreciate you making the time, and this is a very important event, obviously historically, in my opinion. So I think it deserves to be. To be hashed out.
Yep, I agree.
So, Kurt, take care, and I hope to speak to you soon. As this story develops, we'll try to stay in touch, and anything I find, I'll share with you, and vice versa, and we'll hopefully get you back on. We might need to look at this in another dimension very soon. So thank you so much, Kurt.
No problem, anytime.
Kurt Haskell, ladies and gentlemen, he's the witness to the underwear bomber incident, a whistleblower and a former attorney. And what a fantastic bit of research Kurt's done into this event. And we're going to hear more from him in the future, no doubt. We're going to take a short break, and I'm going to connect our next guest. And we're going to get into the deeper Bader Meinhofer themes of the Paris attacks with our next guest, Jay Dyer. This is the Sunday Wire. Hold on right there. We'll be right back after this short break.
The Red Pill Radio Show with me, your host, Ashley Jones. Monday through Thursday from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Take the red pill and see how deep the rabbit hole goes. We'll be right back.
Welcome back. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is the Sunday Wire. I'm your host, Patrick Henningsen. We're streaming out live on the ACR network. That's the alternatecurrentradionetwork.com and streaming out at 21stcenturywire.com. This is the live broadcast. You can also catch us on the recording after the show. Give us a little bit of time, a couple of hours, and we'll have the show up there on the show page for you to download, stream, iTunes, Stitcher, anywhere you want, you can get this program. And also, we'd like to just big thank you out to the people at ACR Network, and of course our producer behind the scenes, Brian, keeping us live this week. And also, thank you to our last guest, Kurt Haskell, who was joining us from his office there in Central America and telling us a little bit about what his research has unveiled with regards to the Paris attacks. So we're going to be joined now by our next guest. Now, I'm bringing on our next guest, who is a frequent contributor to 21st Century Wire and who's also running the head honcho at Jay's Analysis. That's jaysanalysis.com. There's a link to Jay's website on our show page, so you can click through and see his work. Jay's primarily, in my eyes anyway, a film analyst. But, of course, as I said earlier, I think Jay probably sees film as a window, like literature or any form of art, as a window into the world, and we can glean things from art, from literature, from film, to better understand the narratives that are happening in the real world. And in some cases, the real world is imitating the art form. In the case of film and literature, absolutely, we can see these narratives jumping from the celluloid world into the real world, or from the page into the real world, and vice versa. So, Jay Dyer, thank you for joining us this week on the Sunday Wire.
I'm a Renaissance man, Patrick. You're trying to sell me short, paint me as just a film nerd. I'm a Renaissance man.
No. I'm just saying what you're most noted for.
I'm kidding.
Will be film analysis. But yes, you are a Renaissance. You are one of many newly emerging Renaissance men. So when the Paris things first went off, the firecrackers first went off a couple of weeks ago, I know you started on the subject immediately. So, you know, you didn't waste any time, Jay, I didn't waste any time. Neither did Sean Helton, neither did Stuart Hooper. We didn't waste any time in really calling this attack out as something much more in terms of what it looked like anyway, what it looks like, what it says, what it smells like, what it feels like, is a false flag event. Now, when I say false flag event, I'm not just painting the false flag brush there. I'm saying it really, what we've seen in terms of the anomalies, what we've pointed out, what we've flagged out, unanswered questions, and also looking at the media storm, which is a dazzling display of propaganda in order to somehow jam this whole event into a very small little bottle, which is the official story, which is, ISIS has attacked us on European soil, or Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula is now number one terror group in the world after this Paris attack, blah, blah, blah. Troops on the streets in Antwerp, troops on the streets in Belgium, France, and in the UK, armed units now deployed all over Europe. We're at war, okay? That's the sort of official narrative. We're at war with Islamic extremists. What do we do with all these Muslims now? That's what they're saying on CNN, pretty much. What do? We've got too many Muslims. How do we keep track of them? There's 5 million of them in 7 million of them in France or something like this. You know. So what do we do with all these Muslims? Oh, my God. And how do we protect, Jewish schools and other sort of, you know, targets, potential targets, and newspapers like Charlie Hebdo? And so this is the official narrative, Jay. And it's astonishing, Jay, to see how it's been built up like a snowball, and so quickly.
It is. It's as if we are in the midst of a live action Taken film with Liam Neeson, and Liam Neeson should be running around somewhere in Paris. I think in the first one he runs around. I mean, in all of them he runs a lot. It's always sprinting about. But where's Liam Neeson to save us from the terrorists? Yeah, I think that it wasn't very difficult to figure out what was going on here. Not because, you know, we have a knee-jerk reaction to jump at the label of false flag, but because of what we'd been seeing in the news, and it had been a little bit since we'd had our big terror news newscast. We had planes going down and scripts out of the Lost TV series with disappearing planes, Twilight Zone planes, but we hadn't seen Euro terror or Western terror. We've heard about ISIS doing their thing, but we need a new stage of terror in the West. And immediately, France's 9/11 was listed. And like I listed, seven basic principles that we tend to see in all these events. I'm not new to watching these kinds of things. I've been doing this kind of stuff since 2003. Not by any means an expert, but if you watch and look for these kinds of this sort of explanation or thesis of the story is much more rational, coherent, and sensible than anything that mainstream outlets put forth, which, as you've accurately said many times, are really the craziest conspiracy theories, because the conspiracy theories that come out of mainstream media are generally speaking impossible. Because they put forth conspiracy theories that are physically and that transcend the bounds of space and time. And we see passports that do things that don't normally happen in our dimension. Things like this, disappearing fuselage, as you said.
What's the term, Jay? It's a state of suspended disbelief, or you could say suspending real belief. But
well, that's what you're supposed to do in the movie theater, and I think that we're supposed to do that when we turn on our home theaters and watch the news. So, absolutely. But the basic principles that I listed, I won't bore everybody with this, because you pretty much, like I said, desiccated the entire story with Kurt in the first couple of hours. But you have that mainstream media build up and roll out. There's the placards that are ready to go. I'm surprised this time they were in French. A lot of times when those printed placards are available in big riots or coups or events, they're oftentimes in English in foreign countries. No, granted, English is the language of the empire, but nevertheless, the propaganda posters are always pretty and printed up pretty quick for various events. This time it was Je suis Charlie in French. Those are rolled out quickly. Questionable videos, details. There's a security buildup, drills, of course, which provide cover. The perpetrators have shady, beyond belief backgrounds, yet run free. Deep state connections, rap sheets. There's a false dialectic immediately put out in the media, which is what we're in that stage now, where it's the 2D universe of, like I've talked about before, comic book villains. There's only the good guy and the bad guy. No other possible levels of gray or moral quandaries can be brought in here. It's only good guy, bad guy. And, of course, the good guys are always the West. The Western power structure, I should say. Key individuals are liquidated and suicided. Media quickly fingers low-IQ dupes and patsies, magical IDs again. And then the result, predictably, more militarization, more surveillance, more police state. And then we have to hear the endless replay, regurgitation of all the past terror events, which I think is a key to understanding the real story here, is looking at past terror events and dissecting them. But of course, that's not what the fictional mainstream media does. They regurgitate terror's greatest hits from their perspective, of course.
And what are some of those past, quickly, or pick up your thread in a minute, but just quickly interject, what are some of those past events that immediately you're seeing attached to this one, at least by the media or yourself? You know,
well, right away they said the French 9/11. France has had their 9/11. And as you mentioned with Kurt, we think of 7/7. But we think there's a host of other ones, too, that come to mind for me. There's the Bologna bombing. There's Rachid Rahmi Ramda in 1995, the other French event.
Yes.
But for me, I mean, I think all the way back to French terror in the Revolution in 1789 and the Committee for Public Safety, the Paris Commune. And I think it's worth making those kinds of connections because they lead us to understand deeper aspects of Gladio, deeper aspects of the interconnected intelligence networks in particularly Europe, in this case, with the P2 Lodge, which is a sort of Masonic Black Lodge of Italy, and connections to Grand Orient Masonry. And while I'm not interested in getting into, quote, Illuminati stuff, this rather sheds light on how secret societies, covert intelligence groups, they have a lot in common because they traffic in secrets, and so these provide cover. And anytime many political heads and corporate heads are involved in these kinds of groups, that should raise red flags right there. Red flag, there you go, that's a good term. Red Army faction, another part of which had a red flag, part of Gladio. So these are all the things that come to my mind. We think as well of Roberto Calvi and the Vatican Bank scandal, which ended in his death in a curious ritual killing under the Blackfriars Bridge, because we can't, I know I'm kind of getting out there and sounding maybe a little fringe with this, but
no, this is all historical fact, Jay.
Right, but it all connects into these NATO networks and the intelligence agencies and what happened in France, and with the different characters that we've seen, these Koyachi brothers and Kouliabli, and of course different government figures in France, these all have connections to these different networks and secret societies, particularly the supposed, Anwar al-Awlaki being the funder of this Paris cell. Anwar al-Awlaki, of course, dined at the Pentagon shortly after 9/11.
Just quickly, Anwar al-Awlaki, the supposed American passport-holding al-Qaeda leader, Osama bin Laden's deputy of al-Qaeda and so forth, who was allegedly killed in a drone strike. I say allegedly killed in a American drone strike, because that was a kind of a convenient way to basically close the book on this particular individual, who looks to me like he would be a Pentagon asset, at the very least a double agent.
Sure.
So if you don't speak about his relationship with U.S. intelligence or the Pentagon, and you leave that out of the story, then I think you're leaving the most crucial part out of the story. And this is what journalists like Jeremy Scahill routinely do, is they don't want to connect Anwar al-Awlaki to the U.S. intelligence apparatus. Okay, don't ask me why they don't want to do that. That's up for you to find out, or why journalists are completely ignoring and trying to cover that. But that's an important part of the story, in my opinion. It's not a conspiracy theory. It's fact. He has a relationship with U.S. authorities. What is that relationship? If you're a good journalist, you want to find out what that relationship is. If you're just a journalist who's part of the establishment, then you want to cover that part of the relationship and move on to the nice, tidy little narrative that you've constructed here, which is the war on terror, etc., and everything's going to feed into that, the orthodoxy, basically. So, but that's an important part of it. So he is, in my opinion, exactly like Osama bin Laden. He would probably be most likely a CIA asset, at the very least a double agent. And so anything attached to Anwar al-Awlaki is suspect. So you had on CNN, Jay, sorry to interrupt, but there's a guy who is their terrorism expert. His name's Paul Kruschenk. He's on every 5 minutes for the last 2 weeks. And him and Bob Baer, their go-to guy for CNN. And he is the author of a book called Agent Storm. This is the Danish al-Qaeda double agent, a big, fat, red-headed guy named Storm, who we're supposed to believe was Anwar al-Awlaki's friend, who, and he's a CIA double agent. He's a Danish convert to Islam and infiltrated the al-Qaeda hierarchy. And was
is he also a local newscaster? That sounds like a, or is he maybe is he a character on a soap opera?
He could be. He looks like a character actor, and there's nothing believable about this guy's story at all, especially if you consider al-Awlaki's connection with the U.S. intelligence establishment. So Paul Kruschenk, I don't know who he works for or what he is, but he's a kind of a mainstream gatekeeper to kind of inflate and prop up this story to help support the al-Awlaki mythology in the official narrative, just like Paul O'Neill, the Navy SEAL, props up the bin Laden mythology by being out in public, supposedly writing these tell-all books about the bin Laden raid. It props up the idea that bin Laden was actually there in the 2011 raid, when most likely he's died many years ago.
They're vampires, I'm convinced now. I've got a new conspiracy that's going to top mainstream media's conspiracy, and that's that all the al-Qaeda leaders are vampires, because you can't kill them.
Yeah.
Well, they come back to life four or five, 10 times. They're back.
Yeah,
you message board.
They're like cats. They've got 9 lives. Al-Zuqwari was another one. He was al-Qaeda number 2 to bin Laden in Iraq, and he apparently had lost a leg and an arm, was still able to run around and fighting, and he was killed 4 times. Mm-hmm. By the media's reports. He died 4 times and came back to life 4 times. So it's almost that they can't quite work out whether they're going to be dead or alive at any given moment, because they still need them. And these are mascots. These are representatives of the specter of international Islamic terror. And you need to put a face. You know, you need to put a face to the enemy, because the face, the personality is what sells the whole story. If you don't have a personality, you can't sell the story. Like, you know, they do it with world leaders, like, you know, who's the next Hitler. There's like, you know, 10 different Hitlers in the last 10 years, whether it's Saddam Hussein, Bashar al-Assad, Putin's the latest Hitler, we're told. There'll be another Hitler next week.
Never mind that Russia fought Nazis.
No, we don't. Yeah, history. Sure, the Russians lost 30 million people, you know, as opposed to our 300,000 in the Second World War. I mean, it's a slap in the face of Russia to insinuate that Putin's Hitler.
By the way, I'm just going to go ahead like I started this discussion saying I'm a Renaissance man. I'm also an expert. You can just adopt that title. And you don't need to do any checking on that. Just pick a topic, and I'm an expert.
So basically, I'll be
just like the TV. If the TV people can do it, I can do it. I'm an expert.
So I'll be like Anderson Cooper or Landerson Scooper, as I like to call him, and for more on the Paris Charlie Hebdo attack, I'm going to bring in our national security expert Jay Dyer. Jay, are you there?
Well, I've spoken with my contacts. I'm here, Landerson. and my
you've spoken with your sources within the French counterintelligence unit.
I have many sources all over, and they have sent me texts, and they've told me everything that's going on. So you don't need to go anywhere else. I've got all the answers.
Yeah. So what your sources are saying is that should we be on the lookout for sleeper cells that have been activated?
Thousands of sleeper cells in every city.
Wow. Well, that's very worrying indeed, Jay. That's Jay Dyer, our national security expert here at 21st Century Wire. And he's got lots of anonymous sources within law enforcement who he's not allowed to say who they are.
We compromise their cover.
Yeah, we have to take his word for it. And so he's a national security expert or terrorism expert or counterterrorism expert. I mean, Jay, I heard Bob Baer say live on the air, okay? Listen to this. Bob Baer says, and I quote, I've trained a lot of these people. He's talking about the terrorists in Paris over the years. I've trained a lot of these people. This is what they do. This is how they behave. So Bob Baer, former CIA operative, who is CNN's terrorism expert, national security analyst, they call him. And he's trained these people before. And we've got all these Department of Homeland Security spokesmen, General Alexander, we've got, Roger Cohen, Adam Schiff, all those guys. Then Robert McFadden, who's a former, all these ex-spooks, basically, who are coming on the TV. Everyone's government. I mean, and you want to hear okay, I'm sorry to go on a bird walk here, Jay, but there is a woman on CNN, okay, and her name is Julie Kayyem. She supposedly is the former assistant secretary to the Department of Homeland Security, appointed by President Obama, I believe. She's on CNN. And we had Christopher Lee Cornell. Okay, you know it's a patsy when they give you three names. Christopher Lee Cornell is a young 20-year-old from Ohio who, with lots of fanfare in the media, was supposedly arrested at a gun shop on his way to carry out a terrorist plot against the U.S. Capitol this week, and was at the last moment arrested by the FBI. And we find out, of course, that there was an informant who's some kind of a snitch who was, instead of doing jail time, worked for the FBI to help develop this young man, Christopher Lee Cornell, into a terrorist. Help him develop his plans. I quote, that's from the FBI, help him develop his plans. So, in other words, this is a kid, an American kid, who was flirting with converting to Islam. I'm not going to judge him based on whatever he was like or doing, but there's an informant here helping him become, quote, radicalized. And Julie Kayyem on CNN says, she said this of Chris Cornell, okay, whatever you think of this kid, who to me looks like he's been framed, or at least entrapment at the very least by the FBI, and they make a big announcement, we've caught a terrorist, as if. Julie Kayyem from CNN says this, Jay. Clearly, this is a young man with a sense of himself that is much greater than he would ever become. Talk about a character assassination. I mean, how disgusting.
What would have made that more interesting would be if they'd given that guy another name, tack another name on the end of that. And I'm thinking of Christopher Lee Cornell West. And you could have Christopher Lee with an afro.
It's the triple name. You got to have a double barrel name to be.
I was trying to make a dumb joke. I'm coming up with sketch ideas. CNN's a good place for sketch comedy ideas when we hear these goofy situations. But yeah, that immediately makes me think of the New York Times editorial from a couple years ago about the FBI hashing bomb plots. I mean, come on.
Yeah, well, there's that. We've got them all listed, actually, at 21st Century Wire. We're developing a database of our own of patsies and informants, dupes, and other useful idiots. I give credit to Stuart Hooper for that what's a sub-headline in his article, which I believe it's Informants, Patsies, Dupes, and Other Useful Idiots. That pretty much says it all. And we have a little list of those on the Ohio FBI framed article, and you can go in there and read those. But back to the Gladio aspect of the Paris events, Jay. So we've got the Red Army faction, you know, we've got all these Bader-Meinhofer gang, and these were all basically working in and out of Operation Gladio. But we didn't know this until those documents were declassified.
Right.
And carrying out terrorist attacks on European soil, culminating in the Bologna bombings in 1980, which killed many people. And we find out, yes, that was a false flag terror event. But that was the golden age of Euro terror. When you had, you know, Carlos the Jackal and the Popular Liberation Front for Liberation of Palestine, Popular Front for Liberation of Palestine. It's like a Monty Python sketch.
Anything named Liberation Front? I mean,
yeah. And, you know, the National Democratic Party of Germany fighting with the Socialist Democratic Party. You know, then you have the different PLFA, PLA, PLFAE. And then, you know, the film... There was a 2008 film, I don't know if you saw it, it was called The Bader-Meinhof Complex. And very interesting movie, which kind of was done in kind of documentary form to shadow this German, notorious German terrorist gang, which was meant to be, I guess, communist or something like this. They were integral in the Gladio story.
Right.
But that wasn't necessarily pointed out, although it was hinted at in the film. It's a great movie. If you want to go see this film, it's definitely worth your $5.99 or your $10.99. Bader-Meinhof Complex, and watch that next to Carlos the Jackal film, and you can get a kind of an idea of how the porous memberships of these various groups, people moving from group to group, literally. Well, it looks like they're in search of adventure, but we find out most of these people, in fact, were agents moving from group to group.
Yeah, I mean...
Or mercenaries, or both.
Yeah, and to go from radical left, radical right, immediately calls into question the authenticity of one's worldview. And so... You were right to point out Horst Mahler, who is a key figure in the Red Army faction, because he later becomes in trouble for incendiary remarks, you know, regarding Holocaust denial, anti-Semitism, things like that. But previously had been this radical Marxist, so. Yeah, anytime we see these kinds of, total flips in worldviews for key players in different radical movements, I mean, that should immediately raise red flags. I can't believe you didn't like my Christopher Lee Cornell West joke. My goal is to eventually get you to laugh, Patrick.
Okay.
You're right. Like the hardest laugh. I can never get
you. You know, I would laugh.
I'm just not funny.
I'd laugh at that if it was in print, probably, because I know because the way you write, but I'd probably get the satire. That's real satire, by the way, not like Charlie Hebdo, which I don't really class as satire. It's something else altogether, but Jay's...
I got to keep getting off track. I apologize. Again, Daniel Esselin's book, Shadow Masters, is really good for getting into all the back... The undercurrent of all this NATO stuff with, you know, drug running, and you mentioned Carlos the Jackal. He makes an appearance in that book, excuse me, as well as all the connections with Gladio and, like I said, P2 and Grand Orient Masonry being kind of lurking in the background of a lot of this stuff. And it's interesting that the cell model of Gladio, the terror cell model, is pretty much the same cell model that we're seeing with the supposed, you know, Islamic terror cells. As to how extensive those terror cells are, I'm not sure. I'm dubious of anything that mainstream media says when they claim that, you know, there's hundreds of cells, however many countless cells they put out. You know, that's that all, you know, just smacks of getting into the fear narrative. Regardless, again, all of these patterns match up perfectly to Gladio, which, as you pointed out, involved, you know, plans for public displays of terror in public places. So, you know, shooting up malls, theaters, things like that. And that's exactly what we've seen here. You know, the attack on a public location. I guess the deli would be the public location. The magazine location would be somewhat more.
Or a war monument, like in Ottawa with the Ottawa shooting. It was this. One soldier was stationed there at the tomb of the unknown soldier in Ottawa, or whatever, the Eternal Flame. I'm not sure what the an obelisk there in the Canadian capital. And of course, this supposed terrorist, the Ottawa shooter, shows up and apparently shoots a soldier there. And so, very specific in terms of what it represents and how that can be used again in the media. Is very symbolic, a symbolic target. Now, if this person was that mentally ill and on as many prescription drugs as what it looks like from those reports in Canada, there's no way he could have made a cogent, calculated decision that, of course, would carry so much weight in the media afterwards, unless it was something altogether different. So, but...
how many times do we have... Do all the same patterns have to emerge? I mean, think about Mumbai, Madrid, 7-7. I mean, the list goes on and on. Breivik. They all exemplify the same... All these same elements that we've listed. So, you know, I was a bit surprised at the backlash from a lot of people in so-called alternative media, particularly amongst libertarians. They took a lot of issue with the thesis that we put forward, you know, after 4 or 5 days, that this was a false flag, maybe even 3 or 4 days. But, I've read through, probably 10 different articles that were critical and really just going after anyone who called into question or dared to use the F word.
Oh, yeah.
The F word, false flag. F words, false flag. But nobody has any coherent or logical argument against the thesis that it's a false flag. And the problem with that is that when you argue against it, most of the people who were opposing our views tended to basically just prop up the mainstream narrative. Well, the problem is that when you go with the mainstream narrative, you have all these contradicting claims. And you have the mainstream conspiracy theory. So our analysis is much better at synthesizing the data and making a coherent analysis of what probably went on than any of these, these pundits and these goofballs. So, I'd like to hear a good response as to why we're not supposed to look at the false flag aspect of this. I mean, I thought it was interesting that the Ron Paul Institute posted Paul Craig Roberts' article, and that turned into a national media furor, and talking heads were going crazy that, you know, how dare Paul Craig Roberts and Ron Paul, you know, okay posting this article. Again, nobody dared to challenge any of the points made, and I thought Paul Craig Roberts made some good points in his article. Not anywhere near the... all he did was ask questions.
It's a classic. It's a classic thing, Jay. You know, if you're not considering that there's any foul play involved there, then you would not know what to look for, quite frankly. So you wouldn't question or notice the individuals who are intervening after the fact in the story. Some of these media individuals intervening, or if there's any cover-up going on, you wouldn't notice any of that. Okay.
All, so, we have to know is that the West is arming, funding Islamic terror and has been doing that for a long time. But what else do you need?
Yeah, and so you have you know, all these sort of people with supposedly top secret clearance being paraded endlessly in the media, trying to basically tell you what's going on there. You know, so after, well, after the dust settles, okay, let's look at the effect of this. So we have the event, we have the problem, which is the terrorist attack. Then we have the reaction, which is public outrage and fear. And the solutions are now coming out. We had President Obama and David Cameron making a big public appearance the other day, announcing a tough new whatever on against cybersecurity. Tough measures to combat terrorists online, and also hate speech. If you want to extend that as well. The net effect, Jay, after all this, then you have the security state moving in with tougher measures, but the net effect is actually, it's not going to be a more liberal Charlie Hebdo style, provocative media. It's going to be a conservative effect. That's what the net effect will be down the road. So, and then the state will obviously ride on that wave, which is, tighter, restrictions on speech and expression. So they're putting on a big tough front right now, but the reality is that, in the course of events, or the future path from this terrorist event is already being basically beaten and carved out, basically.
Right. Well, yeah, terror is a psychological warfare attack on the populace. It's an asymmetrical attack on the enemy as a whole. It doesn't benefit in this situation, the radical Islamists. It benefits the saviors, who will be, of course, the state, who will be NATO, who will be the Anglo-American establishment. They will be seen again as victims and will step forward with, like you said, all of these new measures, ramp it up even more. But there's a big backlash in this in terms of what's going on in media. That's why all the faux libertarians had to step out and say that it was crazy, and I got called a scumbag for daring to question this.
This all sounds familiar, Jay. You're not patriotic in the aftermath of 9/11 or even the Iraq War in some cases if you dare question government-sanctioned views and opinions. But so, you know, the reality, Jay, is that there's a very small minority that would be sort of radicalized out there. And out of that small minority, an even more remote, smaller, improbable minority within that minority that would actually manage to amass and find thousands of dollars to amass lots of arms and weapons and then be able to carry out a pre-planned, highly coordinated military style choreographed event. Okay, so the odds and the probabilities are shrinking as we look into the realities of this. So, but the point which is constantly left out of the media conversation is, and constantly left out, is the hidden hand of the security state. So that takes them from radicalization of the mind to having real jobs to do, having places to be, meetings to attend, money to and guns to buy, and associates and girlfriends and trips and photographs and staged videos. Okay, and so in a way, if you're one of these patsies or dupes, you know, in the Walter Mitty sense, in the imaginary sense that, there's a seduction, the hopes, the desires, being part of something bigger. But again, it's being groomed, being managed, and then being deployed out to be an actor in one of these live scenarios. And the media will always leave this aspect or possibility out. And if you look back at history, it's not remote. It's absolutely 100% certain that in almost all of these events that we've been able to at least look into through declassified documents or freedom of information or journalists whistleblowing, that yes, the intelligence services are running these groups. Perfect example, Jay, John Brennan and the AP, you know, the raid on the Associated Press last year. Eric Holder, Department of Justice, looking for the names of sources for a story AP was working on for a suicide bomb squad in Yemen. And the lead suicide bomber squad was a CIA double agent. And that's why they raided AP, because they wanted to find out who blew the whistle. And then John Brennan was right in the middle of it. So it was a CIA op. The press somehow got wind of it, a leak maybe. And what do? They go and raid Associated Press's offices illegally, the federal government, to cover up what is one of these potential false flag event.
Yeah, it's a strategy of tension, and that's really all that it is. It's that's again comes out of the Gladio NATO operation, where to divide, manipulate, manage public opinion, create consensus reality. You use all of these tactics are used, and obviously media plays a huge part in that with psychological warfare. And if you read about strategy of tension in regards to Gladio, you'll read about provocateurs. You know, how provocative was the magazine, Charlie Hebdo?
Oh, yeah.
Just, again, sort of playing the part of setting up what I said in another conversation on this subject, more of a trialectic, right? I mean, the public, of course, is duped into dialectics most of the time, but it's possible to have a trialectic, too, where you're either with this so-called liberal sort of cultural Marxist magazine, or you're with the terrorists, to quote Bush, or you're with the superstate. So, once you add in another factor there and put it into a tri-level decision, well, you know, nobody's going to, who's going to be able to think beyond that? If everybody's stuck in a dialectic, once we add another one, it's even more difficult.
Yeah.
If all three of those are false choices, you can have three false choices. It's not like there's only, false choices can only be two.
I think that's what we're looking at here, Jay, with Paris. This has moved in from dialectic into trialectic. So this is multi-dimensional cube that we're looking here.
They're all wrong.
Yeah. So
the superstate is who benefits from it. Cultural Marxism, which is funded by the superstate to keep everybody dumbed down and
at each other's throats.
At each other's throat with provocation. If you disagree with either of those two, well, then you're automatically placed in some sort of radicalized option. You're radical. And it doesn't matter what you I don't believe, I'm not an Islamist. I don't follow Islam. I'm sure that if I were to be on CNN discussing this topic, the experts would immediately cast me as some sort of, well, you're siding with Islam.
Exactly. And
radicals.
That's the way this is being set up. And, the Chris Cornell, Christopher Lee Cornell, his frame up, which was basically timed. In other words, they've been working on him for months, and they just decided, okay, let's just make this thing go live and then put it into the media and attach it to the Paris attacks, which they did. And then all the sort of staged photos come afterwards with Cornell. He's holding a sign. 3 days after the arrest, we show him online with a sign that says 9/11 was an inside job. Okay, how many times have you seen that T-shirt, right? And so he's standing there. So this is America's new face of terror, who is, it looks like to be a victim of entrapment, holding the 9/11 as an inside job. So immediately the government wants you to make the association, and the media does, that anybody who questions the official orthodoxy of 9/11, which is probably many millions of people in the United States, globally, tens of millions of people, if not more, hundreds of millions, question the orthodoxy. So they then should be classed as an extremist, thought criminal, So this is the ridiculousness of how they're framing this up. And Peter Hitchens, Christopher's the late Christopher's brother, wrote a great article in the Daily Mail, which is the headline is, "Don't like the PC mob? Then that makes you a terror threat."
Exactly.
So he basically is talking about Theresa May, a new law that they're ramming through is an emergency measure, of course, which attacks free speech, and like it's never been attacked before. So, you know, there's the counterterrorism security bill slipping quietly and quickly through Parliament, of course, under the fervor of the Paris attacks, is much worse than even the previous incarnation, the Civil Contingencies Act, which is like a posse comitatus type thing. And basically it's saying that it tells you what opinions you should have and which ones you shouldn't have and what classification you'll be under depending on which opinions you have. So this is basically an attack on critical thinking. It's an attack on not just freedom of expression, but freedom of thought. And this is what, like I said at the beginning of the show, George Orwell is 20th century's Nostradamus.
Yeah, exactly. It's like you said to Peter Lavelle on Crosstalk, it makes me think of the Karl Rove, you know, we are history's actors, we'll write what we want, and you will diligently study us, but you're not an actor, you're a reactor, or, you know. And that's essentially what we're supposed to be, is news consumers, just like we are product consumers, just a herd. Yeah, so, again, who's opposed me in this the most? It's mainline libertarians. I've had...
Interesting. So the government wants you to believe, according to, you know, Paris is a perfect example. Okay, so here's the belief set. Yes, all these terrorists are criminal drifters, school dropouts, drug addicted losers, and they do the lion's share of the terrorist dirty work. Okay, so why would you need then to bring thought crime? Because it's pretty obvious you're dealing with a small section of society here, and it wouldn't be too hard to keep an eye on them, especially if they've actually been in institutions and have previous charges and terrorist affiliations.
Yeah, I think of James Bamford's book about the NSA, Body of Secrets. He talks about, in several chapters, all of the 9/11 people had been under, you know, total surveillance for a long time prior to what happened on 9/11.
Surprise.
This is, again, a pattern that almost every time comes up. The suspects that the media tells us are the suspects, but who knows if they even are well known to these agencies that are tasked with surveilling us 24/7. As you pointed out to Kurt, we're supposed to have all these, you know, all this grand panopticon of eyeballs watching us, you know, all the time, all this data that's being collected and analyzed, yet it doesn't seem to stop or pick out the people that are known terrorists.
Yeah, no, there are.
To make this completely obvious, I mean, after 1993, Bin Laden is wanted. The Globe's intelligence agencies can't get him. The best, smartest snipers, special ops people in the world can't get him. They can't find where is he. And mainstream media, CBS, ABC, can go interview him. I mean, come on.
Yeah, just like we can't find Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, but Jeremy Scahill has a direct line to them. And, of course, no one...
How many times did these... I think it was like a year or two ago, did the BBC... No, it was CNN. CNN had 2 years ago. I remember I was in Cincinnati when I saw it on TV. The CNN had an interview with Al-Zawahiri, if I recall.
Oh, Al-Zawahiri. Oh, really? Okay. I think he was supposed to have died.
Maybe it was Zarqawi.
Ayman Zakari. Okay, that's a...
He did a public CNN interview.
That's another mascot. supposedly Bin Laden's number two, or the Al-Qaeda number one. So, again, it's just...
Yeah, he took over, I think, after they droned, supposedly, Al-Laki.
Yeah, he's the Mandarin. He's one of the Mandarin characters from Iron Man 3. It's just like, that was an interesting depiction in that film. But that's kind of what we're dealing with here. These are basically standby. Standby actors that can appear at the right time to basically fill in the blanks of whatever the sort of the narrative is. So and right now it's Yemen. Yeah. Tomorrow will be someone else.
Yeah, I remember too. Did you recall when the ISIS videos were coming out? The Turkish soap opera that had the mirror scene of the ISIS videos?
Yes, exactly the same dress, which came out before the ISIS videos. So right. It begs the question, was ISIS copying this Turkish soap opera, or is this basically the same production team, perhaps, doing these videos, same videos? Again, incredibly staged and contrived.
And then, of course, out pops the classic video with Cooley Abli.
Yeah, and on the back of this, another ISIS video, which they put on heavy rotation on the U.S. With the 10-year-old child. It's completely staged. Doesn't actually show him killing anybody, but very well produced. I mean, it's a professional job. This isn't like amateur stuff, Jay. This is someone within the Western film industry who are basically putting these together. They're shot with, it looks like that was shot with a red or a Canon 7D 35mm lens, high-definition, high-frame video, and produced beautifully. Beautifully produced. This is like cinema-level stuff. This isn't like, and they say, well, ISIS has got a good media department, or ISIS has got a great PR and marketing department. This is, something to look for in the 21st century terror. You know, as I'm supposed to believe that.
Is it DreamWorks?
Yeah, is it Spielberg? Maybe it is Spielberg. I don't know. Maybe not. But it's someone professional. This is Hollywood-level stuff, okay? So this, and so they've taken it to a very high level, and they talk about these as propaganda videos, but yet the only times anybody sees any of these so-called ISIS propaganda videos or Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, these videos, the only people we see them is when they're put on the major networks.
Exactly.
So they're airing all of these so-called terrorist content on CNN, the BBC, ABC, Fox. They're providing the pipeline to the public for all these so-called terrorist, Islamic terror groups internationally. So they are the media platform. The mainstream media is the media platform for global terror.
Yeah, it's like you pointed out, when a New York Magazine responded to the article that I wrote about the Charlie Hebdo event, and I have to thank them. Thank you, Jessica Roy and New York Magazine, because you sent me quite a few readers.
Yeah.
You sent quite a few hits.
I'm jealous, Jay. I'd love a hit piece done. It's great.
That's my second one, so I'm two ahead of you. You've probably had hit pieces done.
Yeah, I've had a few. Yeah, a few people, a few nasty things. But it's great for ratings, so I'm like,
so
I love it.
That's a great point you make there with why does the mainstream media, they like you said, they give free advertising for ISIS pretty much all the time.
Yeah, ISIS, Al-Qaeda, I mean, really stupid videos that they're playing on. You know, stuff that's completely staged. They're saying, and here is a video of ISIS in battle. There's no battle going on. It's just a bunch of guys running around the desert with shooting guns with basketball white high tops on. Okay, it's not a battle. It's not battle videos. Okay, but they're battle videos because the main CNN says it's a battle video. But it's not. It's staged. It's phony. It's as phony as anything that's phony, those ISIS videos. Most of them, they're not battle videos. They're training videos. I mean, they're just the slightly better upgrades of the sort of VHS Al-Qaeda videos that, in Intel Center or Site, those Pentagon media outlets would run from looking at terror training camps in Afghanistan, 1990s. You know, they use those over and over and over. You know,
yeah, those older ones look like when I was in high school, we used to make sketch comedy all the time, and we had, you know, the big VHS recorder that, you know, it's like 20 pounds that you have to hold on your shoulder.
Yeah. And
it looks like the videos look just like the sketch comedy that we would do, about the same budget, same quality.
Yeah, guys on monkey bars or, you know, on the ground doing the sort of crawling under the mesh net, you know, the terrorist training, you know, monkey bars and balance beams and, you know, shooting targets and stuff like that. I mean,
yeah, Islamville. It's a totally ridiculous thing that's not too far from a base where I live. And there's one in Islamburg in Islamville. And the videos from that one, the training videos from that camp, you can see white guys just walking around in the video. White guys with sunglasses, not don't even have beards, just regular dressed Joes walking around.
Oh, very interesting.
Kind of snickering in the Sheikh Gilani videos.
Oh, interesting. I guess they're just your average run of the mill jihadists who just happen to be on set.
Yeah, look like your uncle. You know?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we could do a whole master class on all these sort of terror videos that have been released over the years, but I mean, they're hard. Most of them are hardly believable to anybody who's got any level of a discerning eye. But if you don't have a discerning eye and you're just sitting there zonked out of your head and completely oblivious to how things really work behind the scenes, then of course you're going to think it's exactly what people are telling you it is. And it's almost like a bad joke, Jay. It's almost like they're putting out substandard stuff that is just really ridiculous, and just to see how many people will fall for it. And in a way, to measure, this is the fifth dimension of the war on terror, to measure how stupid the population is at any given time.
Well, I don't doubt that at all. I feel confident there are Pentagon papers and individuals snickering and giggling as all this is released.
Yeah, and purposely leaving breadcrumbs. If that doesn't sound incredibly conspiratorial, I don't know what does. But Jay, thank you so much for joining us this week. Our readers and listeners really enjoying your work, and it's very timely. And you're really giving us a look with your writing into, you know, a different dimension. And I think it's very unique. And
thank you. As a national security expert with my many, many contacts and sources, that's what you should expect.
Yes. That's Jay Dyer, ladies and gentlemen. Back to you, Wolf, but Bear Wolf. So, yeah, thanks so much, Jay. Really appreciate it. And, again, our readers really love your work and looking forward to seeing what you're going to come up with on this subject and other subjects. So Jay's Analysis is the website. You can link to it. There's a link right to it on our show page. You can see Jay's work and also – on 21st Century Wire, we'll occasionally republish what we think are some of the timely stuff that ties into what we're talking about at 21st Century Wire. And thank you so much, Jay Dyer. Thank you very much. That's Jay, and it's been a fantastic show. Kurt Haskell, thank you very much for joining us. What a fantastic segment with Kurt. If you're just tuning in now, go back and listen to the podcast or the recording stream of the show to hear the interview with Kurt breaking down the terrorist attacks in Paris and other false flag events. Thank you, everybody. Thank you so much to our team at 21st Century Wire for really digging in on this subject. And thank you to our readers, the many hundreds of thousands of readers this week who've tuned in to 21stCenturyWire.com. It's a great resource. Go use it, download it, copy it, republish it. Do whatever you want with our content. It's yours. It's there for the people to read and share. So I'm your host, Patrick Henningsen. I'm going to be back next week. We're going to have a little bit of a different program next week, different style, but it's going to be pretty much the same, but a little bit different sort of format and style. So look forward to having you back with us next week on the Sunday Wire. I'm your host, Patrick Henningsen, signing out. Thanks for joining us.
Why the people
You're a child, you're born in the state of mind. In the center of the evils of the humankind. You live, you learn, you start to grow. Full of all the teachers that we all succumb to. I don't know what this world is coming to. Chaos on the boundaries, don't know what to do. I don't know what this life is meant to be. Chaos on the boundaries, can we live another day? I say this day was much harder than tomorrow. Take every day as if it was your last. Remember, nothing's gonna last you forever. Always look unto the future. Keep your head above the stormy eye. And the farther we move on, you'll be the farther from back to me.
Why the people down the bottom, why the people down the bottom crying? Why the people down the bottom, why the people down the bottom crying?
Take my hand, follow me, let's explore what's in view. I remember happy people laughing till the dawn. Is the mind just a maze full of games? What's in store? Maybe we're just bottles floating on the open shore. I don't know what this world is coming to. Chaos on the rafters, I don't know what to do. I don't know what this life is meant to be. Chaos on the rafters, can we live another day? Was much harder than tomorrow. Take every day as if it was your life.